I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I could drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Our good friend Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. We're talking about budget, and also this. The right wing mean that there are these moochers out there. There are these people who want they want everything for nothing, and the poor producers, you know, the very wealthy people, oh, they have to pay. Nonsense. But we'll talk to Dave about that and get your thoughts. Also, Larry Hanley's going to be here in the second hour, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. I'm going to be talking about transportation and the transportation bill that's in the House and in the Senate. I'm looking at it. The White House evidently appears to like the Senate bill. I don't like either of them. I think we need to be investing heavily in infrastructure. We need to be building 21st century technology, 21st century roads, not just patching up the old stuff. The old patches. A little caulk. That'll do it just fine. I go back to what Thomas Friedman said. Came from Beijing to LAX. It's like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. I don't want to be the Flintstones. I think we, for generations, were the world envy when it came to our transportation and our infrastructure, and we have allowed that to fall way behind. Because you've let these folks, we're not going to raise taxes. We promise we won't raise taxes. We're going to cut. This is what you end up with. Also in the second hour, Patrick Russell, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1539 out in Hot Springs, South Dakota, going to be here talking about the VA Medical Center that they're, closing down. Consolidating. And, you know, again, you go back to this, how do we treat the people that we call our heroes? Well, I guess cut, and punish, just like we treat everyone else. And in the third hour, Jane Palmer is going to be here, coordinator for the 2012 Pennsylvania Progressive Summit, put on by the folks at Keystone Progress. So we look forward to talking to her also. Talk Radio News Service is going to get us someone from the CPAC conference, the crazy conservative political action committee. Someone's going to be here talking about what's going on there. Big, I don't know if you saw the news, but there's a big clash, big confrontation. The Occupy people sat down and wanted to talk. So news media thinks that's a big clash, big confrontation. So there you go. The big news today, of course, the president's caving on the contraception idea. And again, you knew he was going to. You knew the Democrats were going to because, well, that's what they have been doing for most of my life anyway. Especially on an issue like this that I don't think is all that big of a deal. No one's losing freedom, but, you know, the Catholic Church got out there early with this, we're losing freedom. And I look at the news report today from Milwaukee, who I guess that diocese is going through bankruptcy. It's been found out that more than 8,000 abused children just went unreported. Don't know how this. I just slipped through the cracks. Completely through the cracks. Don't know how it happened. And I think it's kind of interesting, you know, that the, and I could say some really outrageous stuff. like maybe the reason they're against contraception is, you know, they want more access to more children. I don't know. But, you know, maybe they should get their own house in order first. But I've been thinking about this whole contraception brouhaha, and I keep going back to the number one idea is that no one's forcing anyone to take contraception. If you're a true believer, if you're a true believing Catholic, which understand the majority are not, you know, I used to be a Catholic, I know. But, you know, even if you were a true believer, if it's available to you, you have the free will to abstain. You know, abstinence is a personal choice. And again, I go back to, it's a personal choice, not a policy position. And the right wing in this country has this head-in-the-sand policy mentality that is destructive to society. Look, personal choice, I'm all in favor. Nobody should tell you you have to take it. You can abstain from anything you want, just about. But that's not a public policy position. So I keep looking at this, and I'm thinking about it, and it's driving me nuts, going, you know, well, why is it that 95% of the women who, in the most recent poll, who identified themselves as Catholic, 95% of them have used contraception? Pretty sizable number. You know, if you're a true believer and you truly believe what the church is telling you, which is you're going straight to hell for it, 95% of the parish is going away. So I started thinking about that. Maybe this is the church trying to use the government to keep their believers in line. You know, we need to whip those people in line because evidently we can't do it. Evidently our ideas are, well, not working, so we need something. We need a whip. We need to whip people back in the line. That's all I can, one of the scenarios I can come up with. The other one, like I said yesterday, who the woman I was talking to from Planned Parenthood wouldn't go along with me, but, you know, part of me thinks, you know, look at someone like Rick Santorum. Maybe he was a mistake. Maybe his parents told him, you know, hey, you know, you were the reason we got married, good old-fashioned reason we had to. And, you know, he went through life with this self-loathing, self-hatred, that he wasn't wanted and all this nonsense, and that if his parents would have had contraception, he wouldn't be here. You know, is it possible? Yeah, I think quite frankly it could be. You got Mike Huckabee out there running around saying, today we're all Catholics now. Really? Something like that's going to bring the evangelicals and the Catholics together? Really? Is that going to happen? Maybe we have found the issue that will unite the Christians. Because I got to tell you, I've been waiting for that day when we finally decide that, you know what, no other religion is allowed in the U.S. We have dictated that the First Amendment doesn't matter. We are going to officially sponsor Christianity. That's when the fun would begin. When the Protestants and the Catholics go after each other and all the different little sects that they start eating each other. That would be the fun. And hopefully they'd televise it. So anyway, he has said that, the president has said that, well, he's going to back off a little bit. There's some negotiation, some room, some wiggle room. Now understand, the Catholics, the righties, all of these insaniacs, they don't want compromise. And this is where I think the president's totally off his rocker. There is no compromising with fanatics. There is no compromising with these people. It's not going to happen. So by giving them an exemption, where does it end? You know, the guy we talked to last night, and then, you know, I said, are we going to go back to the days of Lochner? And he says, no, he thought the Lochner decision was the right one. And, you know, I started, I think about this, and I'm going, you know, will this decision be part of what takes us all the way back? You know, if government can say nothing to employers, because this is what this is to me about. This is an employer-employee issue. No one is saying that the employee has to take it or the employer has to take it. It has to be offered. It has to be part of the insurance package. If you're going to sell the product in the U.S., it's part of it. It's got to be part of it. To me, it's an employment issue. So if we're saying that an employer doesn't have to provide this benefit, doesn't have to provide this if they provide health care, then who's to say that, well, they don't have to provide safe working conditions or minimum wage or overtime protection or obey child labor laws? Who's to say that all that stuff doesn't go away now? Because you're taking us backwards. You're using the government to restrict people. And, you know, I always thought that, you know, the government was to help open things up. You know, we went to government, we came together collectively, and we said, there are things we want. There are things we need. I'm hesitant and I'm reluctant to use government to deny and to really go after and exclude. But the righties have done a pretty good job. You know, this idea that, it's our conscience. And I say, don't take it. It's that simple. And the law is really on Obama's side on this. You go through a 2000 ruling by the EEOC, which ruled that failure to provide such coverage violates the 1978 Pregnancy Discrimination Act. So it's got a contraception has to be part of it. It's even upheld in several court challenges, according to Igor Volsky over at the Think Progress blog. He says in 2004, the California Supreme Court upheld the state law in a suit brought by Catholic Charities 6-1, saying that, you know, in this instance, you know, the religious employer had people of other faiths. And even if, and this is where I go back to what I said immediately at the beginning, I think they want to hold their own people in check, because 95% of people, of the people polled, who identified themselves as Catholic women, had taken birth control. So even if you're a Catholic woman working for the Catholic Church and the Catholic Charities or whatever, and you want this, you're having the church denying it to you. It's really kind of, well, archaic. I mean, this really, be afraid. Be afraid when religion takes over the political spectrum. Be afraid when you start seeing people in churches having political rallies. Be afraid when you start seeing them all come together, because we are moving in that direction. The Santorums of the world want us to be the Christian version of Iran. They want a Christian theocracy. And I'm telling you, it is dangerous. I like the First Amendment right where it is. I believe what I want to believe. I practice what I want to practice. And you do too. And I can't tell you what to practice, and you can't tell me what to think. That's fine. As soon as the government starts stepping in and deciding winners and losers based on, oh, this is my preference or my preference, that's when the whole thing breaks down. I don't think it gets any simpler than that. Government should stay out of religion. Completely. Anyway, going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Lots to talk about, lots to get to, the budget, transportation, so much more. We're going to take a quick break, right back with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. Stick around, right back after this.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says Thursday's announcement of an attorney's general settlement with banks on fraudulent mortgage and foreclosure practices is a step towards addressing the housing and foreclosure crisis that still plagues us. The $25 billion settlement provided some compensation for foreclosure victims and homeowners who are underwater on mortgages, without requiring individuals to waive their legal claims. The AFL-CIO applauded Attorneys General Eric Schneiderman, Kamala Harris, and others who the Labor Federation says fought to improve the terms of the settlement. It's their efforts, the AFL-CIO says, that made sure banks have not been released from their liability for fraud and other illegal conduct involving mortgage-backed securities that were central to the Wall Street financial meltdown. The AFL-CIO is urging President Obama to, quote, provide the Federal Investigative Task Force with the resources necessary to address the $750 billion in negative home equity that is the result of illegal conduct by banks, end quote. Two Wisconsin Democratic state lawmakers Thursday introduced a resolution in the Wisconsin legislature calling for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. State Representatives Mark Pocan and Chris Taylor introduced the resolution. Pocan says corporations aren't people and they shouldn't be given the constitutional right to buy elections. Pocan says this is the people's government, not the corporation's government, and corporations should not have the right to usurp the individual's right to free speech. Wisconsin State Representative Taylor says that corporations should not have the same free speech rights that people do. The resolution is part of a national movement to overturn the Money is Speech Citizens United decision. The effort is associated with Move to Amend. Over 1,800 Allstate insurance agents took a survey done by the OPEIU-affiliated National Association of Professional Allstate Agents Incorporated to measure the agent's satisfaction with the giant insurer. Allstate fared very poorly in the NAPAA survey, which used a model similar to Allstate's own customer satisfaction surveys. The company scored less than zero, with a higher percentage of agents ranking the company with negative answers in all categories than those who ranked it positive in every category. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. Workers Independent News is produced and provided by Diversified Media Enterprises, made possible in part by the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Hi, and welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I've got Dave Johnson online, Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know,
good to be here.
You know, here in Pennsylvania, the legislature passed this being the year of the Bible. Pennsylvania, 2012 is the year of the Bible. Then our governor comes out with a budget that just, well, anything but biblical, if you will. Well, maybe Old Testament. And, you know, I'm looking across the aisle, I'm looking at the Republicans, and all I'm seeing is cut, gut, and punish. And to me, what their aims seem to be is, how can we slow this economy down? How can we make things worse so we get that black guy out of the White House?
God, it sure looks like that when Republicans do budgets, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah, you know, they say, you know, it's a moral document, shows your values. You know, the family values people have shown me that, well, they don't have many values and they don't really care about my family.
The contrast between the things these guys say they stand for and then the things they do is just remarkable. And they kind of believe that if they name something, then people will just believe that's what it is. Like the Cleaning the Air Act or whatever they called it that lets all the polluters go, you know, all that kind of stuff they do is so different, the things they say between the things they do. Isn't it amazing?
It is amazing. And, you know, you talk about budgeting, and instead of cutting, gutting, and punishing, why don't we think about investing and getting people back to work and stimulating and some more positive ideas?
Yeah, I'm totally with you here. You know, next week the president outlines his budget. And look at Greece. Look at this whole austerity idea. They're saying, well, let's see, if Greece cuts wages, cuts this, cuts that, cuts out all these government employees, then they'll be able to get out of this debt. But what they're really going to do is they're going to make it so their economy can't grow, and so the debt will just get bigger.
Yep.
I wrote about this idea that the president is going to be putting out his new budget next week, and I had a suggestion. I wrote about this today. It's titled, Here's a Budget That Works. But actually what I did was I just looked back to last year, the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Those are the progressives in the Congress, the people who tend to support labor and things like that. They're almost all Democrats. I think I think they're just in the House, so they're all Democrats. They don't have Bernie Sanders. He's a senator. They came up with a budget last year, a budget proposal, and it's called the People's Budget. And the People's Budget actually balances the budget pretty quickly. It actually takes care of human needs, okay, our priorities, as you were saying.
Yep.
What it does is it cuts military and raises taxes a bunch. Everybody who knows anything about the deficit knows that the reason the deficit is so big is because they, well, under George W. Bush, they doubled the military budget and cut taxes on the rich. Under Reagan, they grossly grew the military budget and cut taxes on the rich. And we just wound up with these massive deficits. So obviously, if you're really going to talk about fixing deficits, start there. But this also protects the social safety net. Now, this is last year's budget, so it also ends the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we're out of Iraq. We've announced that we'll be out of Afghanistan next year. One of the big things that this budget does is it pushes hard on the Make It in America Act stuff,
different
things. It cuts all these tax breaks for sending jobs out of the country, a bunch of things like that. Makes a big difference, and I think it ends the big, giant, huge subsidies we give to oil companies. So
yeah,
why not take a look there?
I'll tell
one
you what.
One more thing, Rick.
I'll tell you why not.
Yeah.
The reason it'll never pass and it'll never even be considered by Republicans is it ends the Bush tax cuts, and it makes the millionaires and billionaires pay just a little bit more.
Yeah, that's the reason. But there's one more thing about this budget is that if you look at all the polling, every line in this budget matches what the public wants, too. So this is what the public wants. The Republicans want to work for the 1%. This is for the 99%. But it's just a fact that the Congress, you're right, is just going to listen to the 1% the way things are now. But the complaints you hear about budgets and deficits and all of these things, and then you hear the Republicans talk about their priorities and their values and all of that. But when you line up with what the public wants, it happens to be that you line up exactly with what this progressive caucus puts in their budget, and it balances the budget, it grows the economy, it brings manufacturing back, it helps people, and that's why it won't be considered, just like you said.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about the 1%. It's all about the very wealthy campaign donors and what they want and their needs, which is why we prop up big business by giving them tax incentives instead of giving money to people to go buy their products.
Right. And anybody who, you say big business, anybody who has a regular sized business, you know, small, medium businesses, they'll tell you that what they want is more customers.
Absolutely.
They don't need these tax cuts. They want more customers. Tax cuts, I'm sure you hand somebody a bunch of money, they'll say, thank you. I used to own a business, and you hand me a bunch of money, I'd say, thank you, and it wouldn't cause me to hire anybody. What would cause me to hire anybody is if I had to fill orders. So that's, you know, and everybody knows this, but they come out with these justifications. They say these things. You know, it's like this big cloud of smoke. They just say stuff, big clouds of smoke come out of their mouths, and then they go ahead and get what they want. And what they want is a bunch of money from the government, tax cuts, handouts, subsidies and things like that, and also rules that keep them on top and hurt their competitors, other companies.
Absolutely. It's not deregulation. We've never deregulated anything. We've re-regulated it to benefit a few at the expense of the rest of us. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. OurFuture.org is the website. Dave does some outstanding writing over there. And, you know, you look at the messaging, and you brought up the messaging that goes into all of this that seems to divide us, and everything is about keeping us apart. And you wrote a great piece, Producers versus Mooshers, which I thought was, you know, kind of right on the spot. I mean, what the right is trying to push is that, well, all those people who are collecting unemployment, all those people who need food assistance, well, they're just moochers. And
you
people who don't get those things and don't need them, well, you're the producers and you should somehow look down on those folks. When, you know, I know a bunch of people who never thought in a million years they were going to need any of them, and they're grateful that it's there.
Well, first of all, I appreciate what you said. Just yesterday, I was outstanding in front of my house. But, no, sorry, that was for the benefit of a bad pun. Look at Mitt Romney. We just saw his tax returns. This guy gets $20 million plus a year. $20 million plus a year from doing nothing because he got all this money. This is money that comes out of when he was destroying companies. And he made all the money basically by either firing people and pocketing the money and shipping the jobs to China, or forcing them to take wage cuts of 50% and lose their benefits. So he's got all this money. So he gets $20 million plus a year for doing nothing and pays very little taxes. He's a producer. He's someone we're supposed to be rewarding. And then you look at people who are working two jobs, and at minimum wage, working two jobs is not enough to pay rent and feed yourself, so they're getting food stamps. So those are the parasites.
Yeah, those are the moochers.
Those are the moochers that live off of people like Romney and try to get him to pay the same amount in taxes even as everybody else pays. But no, he just pays 15%.
Yeah, it's amazing how easily they twist the message. And get you looking in a different direction, get you looking at it through a different perspective. Because, look, you know, the guy who's working out there, like you said, two jobs, trying to make ends meet, and still can't do it, there's something wrong with that scenario. And like I said, when Obama became president, I said the one hope I have for him is that he's the guy who saves work in this country and makes work pay and makes work rewarding again. And what we've seen is we've seen more companies stealing back benefits, stealing back wages. And it's not. I don't see it getting any better anytime real soon.
Well, it's hard. We got this election system, like you said, that the 1% basically funded. Look at one of the campaigns, Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich would be nowhere. And then you got this guy, one billionaire, one of the richest guys in the world, who's giving him so much money. Just this one guy and his family, we're into like 10 to 15 million now.
Yeah,
just
Sheldon.
Kept him going through the primaries and everything. One guy. One, you know, and it turned out that Romney's got a total of 43 major donors, just 43 people in a country of 300 million people, drowning out 300 million people. Just 43 people have this guy Romney running. Romney, the epitome of the 1%. What do we do about it is the question, and that's a tough question because so many people, they get swayed by these TV commercials that this money buys. And they start to believe it, or they get discouraged and don't vote. The first thing to do to fix this is to just vow that no matter what, you will vote. You will not
Absolutely.
Get discouraged, and you will show up and vote. And the next thing is to try to ignore what you see on the TV. It's probably lies. When you see a negative ad, it's probably a lie. And the negative ads are what the corporate funding and the billionaires are so good at. Don't let that dissuade you. Show up and vote, and keep in mind who to vote for. Keep in mind that if they're funded by billionaires, probably not a good idea to vote for them.
Yeah, well, you know, I just see the attack ads this November. Obama hates babies, which is why he didn't want you to have one, over this whole contraception thing, which is, you know, to me just dumb. I mean, this fervor, this outrage, just plain dumb to me.
Yeah, contraception now? Republicans are actually trying to keep contraception now. You know, they said it's all about abortion. Turns out it's birth control. They don't want you to have birth control?
Nope.
I mean, they just, every time I think they've gone nuts, I read something or hear something that makes me think they haven't gone, or they've gone more nuts.
Well, I mean, to me, and it's always been this, my thought always, is they want to take us back to the days before Griswold. Before contraception was legal. That's where they want. So there's no compromising with people who think it should be outlawed. So,
right.
And that's why I think the president's got, you know, something loose in his head or some bad advisors. Look, at the end of the day, these people want to make it illegal. They want to criminalize it. You cannot compromise with that.
That's right. Well, I think his compromise was pretty good. He didn't give an inch on that people are going to get the birth control. The compromise was that, okay, so the Catholic Church employs people who aren't Catholic and want to get birth control, then we'll let them opt out on their conscience. But the insurance company they use still has to pay for it. They just don't have to pay for it. So that's basically, it amounts to the same thing. It lets the Catholic Church say we're not paying for it, but it keeps women especially getting the health services they need. So this time, and I actually tweeted something out about, oh, my God, there he goes caving again. When I heard a little more about it, it sounded better. So this time it doesn't look like we've seen the usual cave that we've all come to fear, you know,
And there's part of me that goes, you know, the whole reason I think they're against it is because they can't have sex anyway. They don't need it. It's not for them.
Well, I don't know. You look at Newt Gingrich and you got to wonder.
No, I mean the priests and the nuns, you know, the Catholic Church. Oh, I mean, okay. They're not using it.
Yeah, okay. God, don't put the visual images in my head of Newt Gingrich. I hear you.
I see the story today. I see the story today in Milwaukee. 8,000 kids that were abused by priests and nuns and the whole rest of them. Somehow we just missed those 8,000. Don't know how that happened. Clerical error. It was a typo.
Well, you know, I read that 98% of Catholic women also use contraception. So this whole thing is really about the power of these people at the top to tell people what to do. It isn't about the moral choice of the Catholics, because they've made that choice already. They're saying we're going ahead. 98%.
Yeah, I saw 95, but 98 quite seems even more logical.
Yeah. So what to do about this, I guess, is just to vow that you'll vote. And more, I'd say, you know, get more involved. A lot of people have tuned out from listening to the news and paying attention and stuff because things get so bad. But then you wind up being much more easily manipulated, I think.
Yeah, and the hope is that, you know, people do, like you said, vow to get out and vote and make sure they get to the polls. And also listen to the Rick Smith Show and be informed.
Of course, that's the main thing. I'd say that, and read ourfuture.org.
There you go, and we've got a link at the ricksmithshow.com. Just click on Dave Johnson's name. Dave, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time, brother.
I'm glad to be on anytime.
Thanks so much. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA and resume the ties as mine. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job and join the people.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Let's take a trip down the political rabbit hole to a mystical universe known as Newtland. This is where Newt Gingrich goes to get high on the fumes of his feverish ego and invent his own reality. For example, the current contender for the GOP presidential nomination has conjured up the fanciful claim that he is not, repeat, not a Washington lobbyist. Since lobbyists are right down there with loan sharks in public approval ratings, Gingrich thought it best to fuzz the reality of his decade-long lobbying career. He now insists that his favor-seeking corporate clients did not hire him for his insider connections in the capital city, but because he's a historian and a transformative thinker. So please believe him when he says that the financial giant, Freddie Mac, paid him $1.6 million over 6 years to give them history lessons. Also, just accept his word that he was paid $55 million by several healthcare corporations between 2001 and 2010 because they merely wanted to bask in the glow of his transformative thoughts. Indeed, when asked by the Washington Post what those clients got for their millions, Gingrich said that he set them up with, quote, a really important guy who really knows a lot and who really has lots of information. That guy was, of course, himself. And yes, admits the former House Speaker, he has chatted up his old congressional cronies about issues of concern to his clients, but he did so as just another concerned citizen. It was not, repeat, not lobbying. This is Jim Hightower saying, who does the Newtster think he's fooling? You can claim that chicken manure is chicken salad, but one whiff reveals the truth. Gingrich's silly semantical dance around the L word is a devastating revelation of his true character. This guy's so full of himself that he believes his own lies.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
We don't think of the bottom up. We do it full of rich and pretty. But don't put a lot. And then we'll pay. Hooray!
Yeah, you're a pirate. What the hell is that? You're a pirate. All right, Bach. All right, well, you know, there you go. Spencer Baucus, Republican from Alabama, he evidently is going to face some type of insider trading charges with the House Financial Services Committee. Wow, gee, that didn't take long, did it? It's only been several months since 60 Minutes broke the story. And, well, you know, it was only from a couple of years ago. Hey, the wheels of justice turning a little slowly. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see where this goes, because some of the early reporting I'm seeing on it points out that, you know, he was kind of a hobby trader. And, well, you know, he's actually lost money. But during the time that they were specifically looking at, while he was working on, you know, trying to save the economy, he was actually betting against it and, well, ended up making a couple of bucks. But what they're saying, what early reports that I'm seeing, he was just a bad trader, probably a bad gambler on top of that, and actually lost money. So this could be another Clinton-type thing, where you're going to spend a whole bunch of money investigating something where you lost money. Because if you remember Whitewater, which was just ridiculous, he lost a boatload of money on that. But that eventually led to Monica and all the other stuff and, you know, all of the fun and games and shenanigans that went along with that. So good. Good. But it looks, hey, the House Investigative Ethics Committee is actually going to maybe think about, oh, I don't know, doing something. So that's a start. And we wonder why Congress has a 10% approval rating. Just a thought. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So the Department of Commerce has come out with their numbers on our deficits of trade. And congratulations. Every American should pat themselves on the back. We have broken a new record. 2011 was a record-breaking year. We bought more things from China than they bought from us, again, but this time at the tune of $295.5 billion. That's an increase from the year before, which had been the record of $273 billion. So, yay, happy about that. We got a whole bunch of cheap stuff from China, so that's good. No? Nobody happy about that? And again, I'm not hearing anyone in Washington all that concerned. We need to kick those welfare people off into the curb. We need to cut the wages of those federal workers. Those public sector workers, they make too much money. They've got pensions. Worried about that. But the trade thing, not so much. And you look at the fact that as a nation, we had and it's just mind-boggling, $558 billion trade deficit with the rest of the world. Now, you stop and think about it. The last time we had a trade surplus in this country as a whole, 1975. And here we are. Well, now some $12 trillion to the negative with our trade. And, you know, is it any wonder that we have a major debt problem, that we have a lot of debt? Not as bad as most countries, but still more than I would like. Does it make any sense to you that we continue to say, oh, yeah, we want free trade, open the borders? In December, our trade deficit went up $49 billion in 1 month. And you go, Merry Christmas? You know, is that it? We're buying all of our Christmas presents from where? From China. And you wonder sometimes. You know, I go back and I look at the stimulus stuff. You know, the cash for clunkers. Who do we stimulate there? Well, the Japanese, the Germans, the Chinese. They're making a lot of parts now. I'm saying, you know, why don't we have strong Buy American provisions? Well, because the free traders, the righties, beholden to big multinational corporations, have said, no, can't have that. So even if we get this payroll extension done, even if we get unemployment benefits extended, which is increasingly looking like it's not going to happen. Because the Republicans have said, well, you know, things are just going poorly, you know. And it's probably not going to happen by the end of the month. And, you know, that unemployment, probably not going to happen. And what you've got is you've got Republicans wanting all of the insanity that they've been trying across the country in different states. You know, they want mandatory GEDs. If you're going to collect unemployment, you got to go get a GED, which I'm not really against. Are you going to fund it? Are you going to make sure that people have the access and the ability and that there are actually programs available? Well, no. Oh, okay. Well, then I'm missing something. They also want drug testing. I'm sorry that we've seen how that works. Not very well. You look down in Florida, they caught a whopping 2%. A whopping 2%. Because it just stands to reason. If they don't have any, people don't have money, chances are they don't have any access to drugs and alcohol. Just a thought. Anyway, the Republicans want to reduce the weeks of benefits down to 59 weeks. Democrats wanted 79. So it looks like they're kind of far apart. Now look, this is a political chess game. The Democrats are going, well, you know, we're gonna hold on the 79 weeks. They wanted the 93, but the Republicans pretty much just laughed them out of the room. Which, you know, I'm not even against. You know, at some point, you got to keep getting money into the economy. But this is a political calculus game. The Democrats are hoping that people turn around and look at Congress and look at the Republicans who are holding this up and say, you're to blame. The reality is, and I think most economists have it right, that if this expires, it's going to damage our economy, and it's going to stop this recovery. And if that happens, I think virtually every political pundit agrees that if this economy takes a downturn, Obama's toast. Which is what the Republicans are working for. Understand why we couldn't get an FAA bill, why we can't get a transportation bill, why we can't get this funding passed through. You know, why do we have to have this to the edge? Why do we have to have this ticking bomb scenario? Because they want that uncertainty. The very uncertainty that they talk about Obama is what they're doing. You know, as an employer, my accountant's going, at the end of the month, we gotta start thinking about how we're gonna rearrange the income tax stuff, and it's gonna cost you a couple of bucks to do that. Thank you, Republicans. Appreciate that. Now, the Republicans seem to be hopeful. By the end of the month, they have listed that there could be a possible vote sometime next week before they take a holiday break, another one. On the Temporary Payroll Tax Cut Continuation Act, very nice name. But, you know, I look at this and I go, why can't we get this simple bit of common sense passed through? And why did you have to tie it all together? You know, I look at the unemployment thing. There are some things that I think we should be doing. Instead of saying, here's more unemployment, I'm a fan of saying, here's a job. Instead of saying, you know, we're going to continue handing out unemployment benefits, get people back to work and follow the minimum wage laws and follow, you know, all of the labor laws of the country. Get people back on the job, building things, doing stuff, and give them some certainty. Because understand, if you're on unemployment right now and you're going, I'm sending out hundreds of resumes, I'm making phone calls, I'm doing everything I can do, but at the end of the month I'm going to lose my benefits and my family is screwed. You want to talk about uncertainty? That, my friends, that's uncertainty. So who are we really concerned about? Oh, I know, we can't tax the billionaires. You know, we can't extend that hand to the folks who are struggling. No, because those are moochers, remember? It's mind-blowing, and it's frustrating on so many levels that they actually have people. I actually saw a group that sent me a press release, pro-choice Republicans. I'm going, really? There's still some of you left that have decided to band together in the in what's become the insane party. It's just like the gay pride people, the log cabin Republicans. I'm going, really? There's still gays in the Republican Party? And that's when you realize, and you realize very quickly, those flaming social issues, they don't really mean a lot to the party. They really don't mean a lot to the people. What really means a lot is the money, the power, the control, which is the only reason you would have somebody who would put out a group like Republicans for Choice. Really? How many pro-choice Republicans hold elective offices? I don't know many. Maybe the two women from Maine. But they're women. And maybe they're not. I'll have to check on that. Anyway, let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm The Talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, male hummingbirds sing with their tail feathers.
The courtship sounds of male hummingbirds don't come from their throats. They're made by wind passing through their tail feathers during steep aerial dives. That's according to a September 2011 paper in the journal Science. Co-author of the paper, Christopher Clark of Yale, figured this out by making a high-speed film of variously shaped hummingbird feathers in an artificial wind chamber.
When Clark analyzed the video, he found that individual hummingbird feathers work together to produce a kind of music. The feathers can produce varieties of sounds. In fact, males of each hummingbird species have their own signature sound. For example, here's a hummingbird called the white-bellied woodstar. And here's a black-chinned hummingbird.
Clark's team found that different notes can be produced by different feathers and work with each other harmonically, like notes in a song. Air moving through the feathers can also make a hummingbird's mating song softer or louder.
All that being the case, said Clark, a male hummingbird's mating success could depend on how well he masters aerodynamic moves, either to show off his flying skill or to generate an alluring sound.
For more, come to EarthSky.org and search for hummingbirds. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
In Wisconsin, they're standing in the snow, wondering where the work is gonna go. In Wisconsin, in the middle of the night, Governor Walker, legislate away their rights.
Yeah, well, that seems what, yesterday we talked about the foreclosure settlement. And it's one of those things where, I was hesitant. I still am. The woman we talked to yesterday from Action United kind of allayed some of my fears. You know, there's some, and the more I've been reading about it, the more I've been like, well, let's wait and see. So I see this story from Wisconsin, where Governor Walker has decided that the share of money that's going to go to the state of Wisconsin, some $31.6 million, that's supposed to help, remember, it was supposed to help people who got screwed over. It was supposed to help people save their homes from foreclosure. Basically, the people who got screwed were supposed to get help. Well, it turns out that Walker has decided the $31.6 million that's coming directly to the state from the federal government, going to close his state's budget gap. They're saying 25.6 will go to help close the budget shortfall revealed in a newly released state projection. So they're going to take the money that they were supposed to help the people who got shafted. They're going to take that and they're going to balance the budget. And Walker says, just like communities and individuals have been affected, the foreclosure crisis has had an impact on the state of Wisconsin in terms of unemployment. He said this will offset that damage done to the state of Wisconsin. So the damage that was done, which I think this is a whole, really should be a whole nother lawsuit, which the states should go after. We're just gonna suck it right out of the settlement. Really? And as I understand, people in Wisconsin not all that happy. You know, I think about this, and not a dime of it should be used for anything other than what it was intended to do, which is to help the people who got shafted. But again, I look at this and there's part of me that says Walker really wants his big payday. He wants to be recalled. He wants to get kicked out so that he can go on to the next step in his career, which maybe working for the Koch brothers. Maybe that's it. Maybe he has given up on being governor, because I can't imagine that this is playing well with the folks in Wisconsin, and the reports that I've seen, not so much. Also, you look at the state address given by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie last month, basically laying out this idea that, well, we need to cut taxes. We're going to cut taxes, and I think he said it was by 10% over the next 3 years. Well, some new analysis out, and guess what? You're not going to get, people in New Jersey, not going to get very much. If you make $50,000 a year, you're going to get about $80. People making over $100,000 would get somewhere around $275. But the millionaires, well, they were somewhere around $7,300 in their pocket. So again, much like the Bush tax handouts, heavily weighted towards the top, heavily weighted towards making sure that the folks at the very top are well taken care of and well cared for. And, hey, that's how it's supposed to be, isn't it? I mean, that is what our tax system has done, has made sure that the very wealthy in this country have been well taken care of for and well healed, if you will. Now, I look at this story that was in the New York Times. It was an op-ed, really. This guy was talking about Mark Zuckerberg and his IPO. Because they're putting Facebook up for an IPO, and it's gonna realize a boatload of money, but he goes into this scenario on really how the rich people stay away from paying taxes. People like Buffett and people like Gates. How is it that their tax rates are so low? They have these massive fortunes, but they're not paying tax on it. And he goes into it, and this is something I've known, but I haven't really talked about in the past. What they're able to do is they're able to borrow money, massive amounts of money. This is how Trump stays, how Trump is able to file bankruptcy again and again, because he keeps borrowing money, other people's money, of course, to do all of these other things. So on the value of their stock, they go and they borrow money. Well, if you borrow money from a bank, you're paying a little bit of interest back, which you get to deduct off of your taxes, but you don't have to pay any income tax on it. That's just how it is, nothing. And this is how they're avoiding paying income tax across the globe. And this guy suggests a market-to-market tax, which means if you hold, like $1 billion worth of stock, that they're going to put a very small tax on your holdings. Because, here we have this concept of realization. It's not until you sell the stock and actually, or sell the property, until you actually get the gain from it. What he's saying to do, and it's probably not a bad idea, because I do believe we need to have, a real serious conversation on how to get revenue into our government. How do we pay for the things that we want and need? And this guy's come up with an idea of, hey, You know, you put a very, very small tax on these really high incomes on what they're sitting on. Cause they're not paying income tax because they're not making any money. They're not working for it. And this is what I love. You know, well, they're the producers. What are they producing? Nothing. They have a lot of money that somehow, is that producing? I don't think so. You know, I wish I were born with a silver spoon in my mouth. But at the end of the day, and this is where, you know, where I come back to on this. How do you make sure that we fund the things that we need? I mean, you look at our infrastructure. When we come back after the break here in the first hour, we're going to talk with Larry Handley, the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU, about our transportation needs. How are you going to fund that? I mean, the engineers, the Society of Civil Engineers is saying, we need a couple trillion dollars, $262 billion a year. What I hear the right wing saying, the Republicans have come out with, hey, well, let's have $260 billion over 5 years. How are we going to fund that? Are we going to fund that through less education and less health care, or are we going to fund it from where the wealth actually is? See, we've really gotten into a scenario, and I guess it says a lot about us as a working class. It says a lot about us as you know, middle income, middle class, whatever you want to say, and the education systems that we've had, that we've been sold into this idea that, well, you know, they should be able to have all that. I don't know. I look at the budget that Corbett came out with, and I'm really struggling with this. I'm struggling with the idea that we're going to enrich the already enriched. We're going to continue to keep the plush already plush. At the same time, while we're talking about ending programs that put food on the table, we're ending programs like the school nutrition program. I go back to, you know, when I was a kid, and I had benefited from some of the Great Society programs, I'll be honest. I remember summertimes going to the local school and there being a hot meal for lunch. It wasn't much, you know, maybe a little mac and cheese, beans and wieners, something like that, but it was something. And the idea was there was something nutritional, there was something hot, there was something that every day. And you knew that some of the kids in the line, that was the only hot meal they got that entire day. And I remember Ronald Reagan coming in and ending that program. And I remember the whole discussion about ketchup as a vegetable, and I remember all the stuff that went around that, gutting those programs, while all the while enriching big multinationals, while all the while spending trillions of dollars on weapons systems. Kind of like we're doing now, only we're, instead of buying weapons systems, we're loading up on the very wealthy. We're filling the coffers of the already very comfortable. And I don't, I'm not sure I don't know how you can agree with that. Anyway, when we come back after the break, Larry Handley will be here, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union. I'm going to talk about this transportation. And like I said, there's right now is the time to be investing. Right now is the time where we should be looking at getting people back to work by doing all of this stuff. And the Republicans are trying to divide the country over this Keystone XL thing, which again, you know, I'm all for building stuff. But let's just make sure it benefits us first. Let's take a quick break right back after this.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
The AFL-CIO says Thursday's announcement of an attorney's general settlement with banks on fraudulent mortgage and foreclosure practices is a step towards addressing the housing and foreclosure crisis that still plagues us. The $25 billion settlement provided some compensation for foreclosure victims and homeowners who are underwater on mortgages without requiring individuals to waive their legal claims. The AFL-CIO applauded Attorneys General Eric Schneiderman, Kamala Harris, and others who the Labor Federation says fought to improve the terms of the settlement. It's their efforts, the AFL-CIO says, that made sure banks have not been released from their liability for fraud and other illegal conduct involving mortgage-backed securities that were central to the Wall Street financial meltdown. The AFL-CIO is urging President Obama to, quote, provide the Federal Investigative Task Force with the resources necessary to address the $750 billion in negative home equity that is the result of illegal conduct by banks, end quote. Two Wisconsin Democratic state lawmakers Thursday introduced a resolution in the Wisconsin legislature calling for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. State Representatives Mark Pocan and Chris Taylor introduced the resolution. Pocan says corporations aren't people and they shouldn't be given the constitutional right to buy elections. Pocan says this is the people's government, not the corporation's government, and corporations should not have the right to usurp the individual's right to free speech. Wisconsin State Representative Taylor says that corporations should not have the same free speech rights that people do. The resolution is part of a national movement to overturn the Money is Speech Citizens United decision. The effort is associated with Move to Amend. Over 1,800 Allstate insurance agents took a survey done by the OPEIU-affiliated National Association of Professional Allstate Agents Incorporated to measure the agents' satisfaction with the giant insurer. Allstate fared very poorly in the NAPAA survey, which used a model similar to Allstate's own customer satisfaction surveys. The company scored less than zero, with a higher percentage of agents ranking the company with negative answers in all categories than those who ranked it positive in every category. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. Workers Independent News is produced and provided by Diversified Media Enterprises, made possible in part by the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
So Larry Hanley's going to be a little late. We'll try and get him a little later in the hour. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Yesterday, Benedict at Large tweeted us, why is infrastructure repair stimulus? Is it stimulus when I repaint my home or repair a broken pipe? And, you know, the reality is, look, I get the point. You know, we should be doing these things as a matter of course. It shouldn't be used as stimulus. It should be the thing we've been doing all along. But what's gone on for so long is this starve the beast, this starve government. And things just keep getting pushed off. The immediate needs keep popping up, and that's where the revenues keeps going, which is why the governor here came up with a great innovation. Like he invented something. The innovation of block grants. How many people remember the 90s in block grants? Oh, those worked wonderfully. Saw that movie, been there, done that. Didn't work well. So we're going to, I guess we've re-innovated. We're going to now use block grants for public welfare and for education, which is basically saying, here's enough money to get you through about half of the year. Then you're on your own. Be it, you know, for public welfare or for education. And, you know, I can't believe we're falling for it. Stop and think about it. If a county gets money from the state, about a 30% cut, as I understand it, over what they had last year. They get this block grant of money. They go about 6-7 months. Then they're broke. Then what happens? I guess I'm going to wait and see. Maybe we have mass uprising. I don't know. I'm kind of the mindset that nothing ever changes without pain and misery. There are no changes until people are negatively affected, until your stomach's empty. What's going to happen? I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. We're going to see more situations like Chester Upland. We're going to see more situations where, as you're moving towards the end of the year, the school district's going, we don't have any money to pay the teachers. They're either going to have to work for free or we're going to shut the doors till the end of the year. And, oh, by the way, you high school seniors, sorry. But it's what we've been doing to our infrastructure. I mean, it's easy to overlook. The bridges aren't falling down right away. So it's easy to overlook, and that's what we've been doing. We've been walking away from it. Now we're doing it to education. And you look at the bill that both of them are putting out, both the Senate Democrats and the House Republicans, and it's not enough. What was the ones, $109 billion over a couple of years? I think 2 years. And the other one is $260 over 5 years. It's not enough, especially when you look at the numbers. The folks over at the American Society of Civil Engineers are saying we need some $2.2 trillion over the next few years to build our infrastructure. $262 billion at minimum per year. And yet we've got the House Republicans saying, well, over 5 years, we can give you a little less than that. And, the broken pipe, well, the pipe's broken. And the house needs to be painted. But we don't have the political will. We just don't have it. And you look at this CBO report that they've come out with saying that the Republican plan going to hurt. Going to really hurt public transportation. Mass transit, screwed. In fact, it's only going to cover about 5% of the mass transit needs. Because remember, they hate public transportation. Why? Bought and paid for. The oil industry, the car part industry, the car industry. I mean, I don't know how much more we need to see before we wake up to the realization that they don't have any interest. They just don't have any interest in helping this nation get off the juice. They don't have any interest in streamlining transportation. They don't have any interest in building new roads or bridges. They just don't seem to have it. Or maybe they will if a Republican wins in November. Because what we've done is we've come to this place where now you have the party structures who are set up only to stop the other side. And while the Democrats are much weaker at it, and I do believe it's because they have some compassion, the Republicans have this scorched earth mentality that it doesn't matter as long as they win. And they think, I can only imagine that they think once they win and they take control, that they can then go back and fix all the things that have been broken. And I guess the question then becomes, at what point do we end up having, well, none of that, where it's too late? I don't want to be so far behind the rest of the industrialized world in everything else. I just don't think it's the right way to go. And now we see the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're coming out with a multi-million-dollar ad campaign. They're going to help 11 Republicans in House races and 8 in Senate races. Because got to keep their people in. Multi-million-dollar ads, and it's all over this Keystone XL project. Which I got an email from Andy the other day. It said, commending me for doing a reasonable job explaining it. Which to me, look, if you could tell me that the oil we're getting from the tar sands, that oil were coming here to the U.S., being distributed here in the U.S., and was going to somehow bring down my price at the pump, I'd be all for it. But it's not doing that. It's going into the, it's just going into the general pool. Which at some point you got to start thinking, well, you know, how do we produce our own energy? Because if you remember the natural gas here, here in Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale that they told us is gonna solve all of our energy needs. They want to sell that overseas now. So it's no longer going to be something that benefits Pennsylvania or even the U.S. It's now global. It's now you've got these foreign corporations and these multi-state corporations who are saying, well, you know, we're taking it. We're going to sell it where we can get the best price. We don't care about the energy needs of the nation. It's all about making a profit. I just scratch my head. Because you hope at some point that someone wakes up to the realization that we do need energy. And why are we shipping ours overseas? You know, last year we were a net exporter of energy. And yet I go to the gas pump and it's still $3.55, $3.60 a gallon. How is that possible? How is it possible that we're producing so much? We have a surplus. We have so much that we're shipping it overseas, and yet it's still higher than it's been in the last 20 years. I mean, we're right back up to the peaks. What's it going to take? And you know what they're doing? They're blaming Obama for this. Well, it's Obama's fault. No, it's nothing to do with him. It has everything to do with our policies. You know, the trade policies that were put into place by the last couple of administrations, bad policies. And the fact that there's no alternative. You want to get to work, you got to drive your car. You want to heat your home, you got a couple of ideas. You got a couple. You can get the natural gas, which right now is on the downward slide. Or you can use oil, which, you know, we're closing a couple of refineries in Pittsburgh, so expect your prices to spike because you're going to see a tightened supply. Or electricity. We're going to burn coal. Those are your options. You know, nobody's out there saying, well, we need to. I mean, some Democrats are, and the president has made a slight commitment to solar and alternatives. But for the most part, it's burn, baby, burn. And now we see that the other day there, I read a report, new nuke plant, I guess, going up. Is that a good thing? Do we need another one? I think it said we had 110 across the country, which, again, goes to tell you how many we're going to need if we're going to move over to nuclear. But where are the billions of dollars in that going to come from? Now, the Keystone XL thing, you know, I've had people tell me, well, the whole reason that they're for it is it's private money. It's not government money going into it. And I'm okay with that if you can tell me that it's something that we need. Is it going to benefit us? Or are we just the pass-through? I don't want to just be the place where, well, we're just passing through. Yeah, never mind the cause of the trouble we're going to cause. We're just passing our way through. Kind of like they're doing up in the northeast here and across the Marcellus Shale fields. Just passing through. We won't even know we're here. It'll be like a little Christmas tree. And then you find your water's been contaminated. You find your... The air's got a special smell to it. I mean, it's one thing to wake up in the morning and go outside and go, ah, smell that fresh country air. It smells like cows and pigs and everything else. It's another thing to go out there and smell the sulfur and the smell of the methane and the smell from the fluids of the frack water. I don't know. Where are we heading? Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around.
Hey, working man like me. I ain't never been on welfare, and that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Rick.
Let's take a trip down the political rabbit hole to a mystical universe known as Newtland. This is where Newt Gingrich goes to get high on the fumes of his feverish ego and invent his own reality. For example, the current contender for the GOP presidential nomination has conjured up the fanciful claim that he is not, repeat, not a Washington lobbyist. Since lobbyists are right down there with loan sharks in public approval ratings, Gingrich thought it best to fuzz the reality of his decade-long lobbying career. He now insists that his favor-seeking corporate clients did not hire him for his insider connections in the capital city, but because he's a historian and a transformative thinker. So please believe him when he says that the financial giant, Freddie Mac, paid him $1.6 million over 6 years to give them history lessons. Also, just accept his word that he was paid $55 million by several healthcare corporations between 2001 and 2010 because they merely wanted to bask in the glow of his transformative thoughts. Indeed, when asked by the Washington Post what those clients got for their millions, Gingrich said that he set them up with, quote, a really important guy who really knows a lot and who really has lots of information. That guy was, of course, himself. And yes, admits the former House Speaker, he has chatted up his old congressional cronies about issues of concern to his clients, but he did so as just another concerned citizen. It was not, repeat, not lobbying. This is Jim Hightower saying, who does the Newtster think he's fooling? You can claim that chicken manure is chicken salad, but one whiff reveals the truth. Gingrich's silly semantical dance around the L word is a devastating revelation of his true character. This guy's so full of himself that he believes his own lies.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
It's time for change. It's time to rearrange.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me. We're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say, revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So the rumors on the Twitters, Kim Jong-un has been assassinated, according to the rumors. They're saying that it originated somewhere on a Chinese microblogging service and have spread across the globe. No reports if it's true or not, probably not. But, you know, you gotta love a good rumor when it takes off. So good. I'm sure that it made, you know, some of the folks happy on the radical right if Un was gone. And maybe some of the people who, of North Korea. I'm wondering what's gonna happen there, cause there's talk in the South of reunification. So I'm kinda wondering how that's going. Because they're actually talking about raising taxes and raising a fund, to help reunify, Korea, kind of like the Germans did, and I remember reading a couple of stories that there were actually talks on how the Germans did it with the East and the West, and we'll see. We'll see what happens. I don't know if you saw this today. There was a really good story on one of the Pittsburgh TV stations about the charter schools. Gotta love our charter schools. Students at almost half of the charter schools in Pennsylvania evidently made less than the average yearly progress to AYP, according to this Stanford study. The first charter school, this Keystone Education Center, that they had focused on, out there in the Pittsburgh area, run by this Gentile family, a for-profit corporation. In fact, they didn't say the guy was a principal of the school. He was the CEO of the school. But, you know, this is one of the first ones in 93, they started this up, and their CEO and his four sons worked there. And you gotta love the fact that the guy, it's a family business. We run this like a family business. No, it's education. These are teaching kids. It's not a family business. But I was surprised. At the very first charter school ever started in the state of Pennsylvania, the number of kids who met the minimum requirements for reading and math skills, 15%. 15%. I was told, you know, the charter schools were going to be a way out, you know, of the failing schools for kids who are in failing schools. 15%. Now, I can understand the cyber charter guy who came out and said, well, you know, our test scores are, you know, below 20%. You know, they're not really good because people keep jumping in and out. Because these cyber charters, less than a 20% AYP. So less than 20% of their students in reading and math. And I can almost understand that. They pop in, they pop out. But this charter school, since 93 they've been in existence. And now you got 15%. That's it? 15%? And you go, well, what's it all about? I mean, why are they in quote unquote business? Well, it turns out the family owns the building. And they rent this building to the school district. They rent the building back, and plus they get tuition. In fact, the tuition, somewhere around $3 million that they took. And you have all these kids failing. So the guy asked him, why? Why is it that your schools are failing so badly? You know, what's your excuse? He says, well, you know, more than 40% of our students, well, they have special needs. And I'm going, let's make that argument. Let's go down that path. 40% have special needs. So 40% fail. Those 40% had special needs, they all failed. How is it that you only have 15%? Explain that. How is it that the rest of them, the other 45% fell through the cracks? No real excuse there. Now think about this. 40% of the kids in this school, this Keystone charter school, 40% of them are special needs. In the state of Pennsylvania, for a special needs child, they pay $18,000 per student instead of the $9,000 that they would pay for someone who isn't labeled special need. So they're making a ton of bank off of this. Not to mention they own the building, not to mention all of the other things that come along with it. So they're making pretty good money off of this school district. So the reporter goes to him and says, explain this to me. You know, you've got all these kids failing. What are they getting? So one of the sons goes, well, they're getting much more than book value. Getting more than book value education. They're getting an education in life and about attitude and working hard and coming out with a positive attitude. And, you know, my first thought is, well, you know, if all you're getting is a lesson in life, an education in life, well, you can do that on the streets. But the reporter goes, well, but is that attitude going to get him a job? And this guy's like, oh, most definitely it's going to get him a job. I guess you don't need to read or write or be able to do math or do any of that other stuff. You just need to have a positive attitude, I guess. Now, they went through and talked about some of the other charter schools. And to me, these charter schools are just a bad idea. You look at the one we talked about yesterday up in the Pocono Mountain School District, this one run by the Shawnee Tabernacle Church, who now we find out through the Auditor General has taken some, according to him, taken more than $3 million in taxpayer money for themselves, which is what this is about. This isn't about educating kids so much it is about lining your pockets. So you look at this charter school law, which I think is a dumb idea. I really do. Anytime you talk about splitting the pot, you have problems, especially in a scenario where once you split the pot, you have to pay one entity, the charter school, the for-profit charter school, over the other one. Over your public school, which is what's going on in Chester Upland School District, and what's going on up here in the Pocono Mountain School District, as I'm told. Now, you look through the report on this Shawnee Tabernacle Church, who back in 86-87 charged $396,000 for the building that they had this church, that they had the school in. The 2009-2010 year, almost $1 million. So you're talking more than two and a half times. And in a bad market. Not to mention they also charged almost $800,000 worth of stuff that they used, that the church used. And you go, why aren't people in jail? And I'm hoping that we start throwing people in jail for this. This is a horrible idea. And you look at the Stanford University study that came out, and Sam Reardon, the guy who was part of the study, one of the authors of the study, they found that the gap in standardized tests between very wealthy and low-income students had grown by 40% since 1960. And you go, well, how is that possible? How is it possible that you've had, again, more growing apart? Again, the alligator jaws getting wider. The inequality, the inequity, how is it getting wider? Well, it comes down to how we fund schools. The wealthier areas, the good zip codes, they have good schools because they invest in those schools. The poorer areas, like the Chester Uplands, well, they don't have the tax base. So they don't have the same opportunity, which is why I have always said we should have one pot of money for all the schools. So it raises everybody up. So if Montgomery County, the school district over there, wants to have $22,000 worth of funding per student, well, every student should have it. Oh, but that's socialism. No, it's called giving kids an opportunity. It's called having public education that we actually believe in and invest in. It's amazing to me that, you know, I'm looking at this, $9,000 or $18,000 for this charter school, and they're failing horribly. I don't even know that the local public school in that area spends $9,000 per student. It's mind-blowing. And you look at this other study by the folks over at the University of Michigan. They found the imbalance between the very wealthy and poor in college completion to be way out of whack. In fact, they say it's the single most important predictor of success in the workforce, and it has grown by 50% since the late 80s. And again, what do we keep here on the right doing? What do we see Tom Corbett doing here in Pennsylvania? Blocking that opportunity. Making sure these kids don't have an opportunity to get the education because they can't take on the massive loans. Nobody's going to be able to co-sign for them. It's not going to be there. And what does that mean for us as a society when you have a generation that are really left behind because, oh, we didn't want to raise taxes on Mitt Romney. We've got an interesting time ahead. We most certainly have an interesting time ahead. And you know, when you look at this education thing, you know, I want my kids to have every opportunity possible. Just like I want every kid to have every opportunity possible. Because you know what? Someday I may need that kid who finished last in his class to be able to put a needle in my arm or be able to do something to save my behind. But I guess we don't think about that like that, do we? I guess not. Anyway, let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I got a picture in my pocket of a lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Teaching America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky,
today.
Male hummingbirds sing with their tail feathers.
The courtship sounds of male hummingbirds don't come from their throats. They're made by wind passing through their tail feathers during steep aerial dives. That's according to a September 2011 paper in the journal Science. Co-author of the paper, Christopher Clark of Yale, figured this out by making a high-speed film of variously shaped hummingbird feathers in an artificial wind chamber.
When Clark analyzed the video, he found that individual hummingbird feathers work together to produce a kind of music. The feathers can produce varieties of sounds. In fact, males of each hummingbird species have their own signature sound. For example, here's a hummingbird called the white-bellied woodstar. And here's a black-chinned hummingbird.
Clark's team found that different notes can be produced by different feathers and work with each other harmonically, like notes in a song. Air moving through the feathers can also make a hummingbird's mating song softer or louder.
All that being the case, said Clark, a male hummingbird's mating success could depend on how well he masters aerodynamic moves, either to show off his flying skill or to generate an alluring sound.
For more, come to earthsky.org and search for hummingbirds. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, for the longest time, we talk about this. How the right has done a masterful job, and really the whole political class has done a masterful job of using the folks from after 9/11 who rushed into the building, the police, the fire, the construction workers, put them up on pedestals and said, these are our heroes. The same thing with the men and women who went to Iraq and Afghanistan. We've put them up on this pedestal saying, hey, these are our heroes. But when it comes time to help them, it seems that we're not so interested. And I look back at, you know, the people who did go into the buildings on 9/11 and who did clean up that mess and how long it took to get them some respect and some health care and some dignity. Just plain wrong. And I look at across the country as we're closing VA hospitals and doing some of the things that I think are just plain wrong and dumb, to be honest. And it infuriates me. That's why I've asked Patrick Russell, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 1539. He represents folks who work at the Hot Springs, South Dakota VA Medical Center. I guess they're closing this, which is why I've got Patrick on. Patrick, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me, what's going on with this VA center there in Hot Springs, South Dakota?
Well, first of all, the Hot Springs VA Medical Center is part of the Black Hills Healthcare System, which is Fort Meade, South Dakota, and Hot Springs, which were merged in 1995. On December 12th, we had a town hall meeting at which our director made an announcement that they were planning to move our domiciliary from Hot Springs up to Rapid City, which is 55 miles north of us, and over a four-year period close up the VA Medical Center altogether. At the town hall meetings, he told the veterans in the community that they could get their health care provided at their local community hospitals and to build a VA. And a lot of the stories going around about the promises being made about the VA building wings for the local community hospitals to accommodate their veterans, to take on the veteran health care issues, and the VA would pay the bills. We have a lot of questions about the legality of that. and whether or not the local community hospitals could actually take on the added workload.
Especially since I would assume some of the injuries and some of the care that veterans need is highly specific and in need of high-trained folks.
Oh, absolutely. We're getting comments not only from veterans but also from providers at the private sector who do not have the background for being able to recognize or treat post-traumatic stress disorder, Agent Orange syndrome, Gulf syndrome, and other disorders which are unique to veterans.
So in looking at this, how much of this is privatization, just your general privatization, and how much of it do you think is an actual act to try and kill the VA altogether?
Now, this is me speaking because nothing has come out formally yet. This is the first time we have had a center director tell veterans to go to their local community hospitals and bill the VA for your care. Other situations have come up like this. The VA will enter into a contract with a local hospital and tell the veterans to go to XYZ hospital, and we have an agreement with them to pay the care. What they are telling veterans now is that you go out to the community, go to any hospital you want, we will pay the bills. It's like we're becoming an insurance company. And because what I see, if this is allowed to proceed, that the VA will become just another insurance company which will either okay or deny your inpatient care and your surgery care. Now, the VA still wants to maintain outpatient clinics.
Okay.
But they want to have contract specialists to manage fee basis contracts for inpatient care and surgery. And in that case, we're going to be the largest insurance company in the United States.
Yeah, I don't think I like that.
I don't think our veterans will like that.
I mean, you know, a lot of the stories that I've heard lately, you know, there's this push, and this all kind of falls into place for me. There's this push on the right to try and say, well, you know, the VA hospitals are so far apart because, you know, they've done a nice job of closing a lot of them down. So there's been this push to kind of do what you've laid out. I think Gingrich is a big supporter of this, and a couple of the other Republican presidential candidates pushing this idea of, well, we'll just privatize it and then we'll run the VA like that. That's scary to me.
It is scary, and I have to congratulate the people from our community who have banded together to form 14 different work groups looking at different aspects of this proposal that has been put forward. One of the work groups has been calling up other VAs in the country which have either closed down because of this push to get rid of the smaller VAs, or in some cases they have beat back the VA in these proposals. In the facilities where the VAs were allowed to close, the veterans now feel like they're getting second-rate care. And specifically, veterans who were contacted in Grand Island, Nebraska, after they closed up their ICU and their inpatient care, and they contracted with the local community hospital, and after 3 to 4 years, the VA did not renew the contract with the local community hospital. And now the veterans from Grand Island, Nebraska, are stabilized at the community hospital and then transported down to Omaha. So family members have a 3-hour drive to go see their loved one in the hospital.
Wow, that's outrageous. You keep saying community hospitals. Do you mean just the hospitals that are in the local area, or are they actually community hospitals? Because it's my understanding most true community hospitals are gone. What we've got are these for-profit institutions that just want to suck as much money out of the system as they can.
Well, you know, these community hospitals, they may be affiliated with larger regional hospitals. You know, I don't know the owners of, like, Regional West in Scottsbluff, Nebraska. I do not know who owns or operates the Custer Community Hospital. They may be standalone by the community, or sometimes they're faith-based hospitals, you know, funded by a religious organization. Sometimes they are a satellite hospital of a Metropolitan Hospital.
So, and I appreciate the honesty, because, you know, I just wanted to clarify that, because, you know, so much of what we're seeing is this push to privatization by the people who are making the profits. And to me, anytime we privatize something that we should be doing ourselves, healthcare being one of them, especially caring for our veterans, I'm always cognizant of the fact that there's someone out there trying to make a buck off of it.
And we have many concerns about that. And we are still waiting on our FOIA requests. We have approximately 35 FOIA requests we have submitted to the VA to prepare our comments and counterproposals. And some of those FOIA requests concern the cost per day for patient care of local community hospitals versus our own VA medical center. I did ask for these numbers about 7 years ago, and at that time it cost $1,500 a day for, let's say, somebody with pneumonia or influenza at our VA. At the regional hospital in Rapid City, it cost $3,000 a day. It was twice the amount. And these are things that our management is not telling you, the taxpayer. How much will it cost you as a taxpayer to take care of that patient versus what it costs in the VA system?
Because I was going to ask you that. I mean, is it cost effective to be closing down a hospital that you already have, that's already staffed, that's already working, and then build on to other hospitals and guarantee them payments? And I don't see how it's beneficial cost-wise.
Well, in our case, it's not just the hospital. We do have a domiciliary attached to our facility here. And our management wants to build a brand new a domiciliary up in Rapid City for $34 million.
Wow.
And that's for a building we already have here at our VA. This VA was built in 1907. So our director is using the excuse that your building is too old and it's too costly and it should be closed up and just scrapped and let us build a brand new one. And we have people working to look at the feasibility study of how much it would cost to make the improvements needed in these old sandstone buildings to bring it up to ADA requirements, provide the care that our patients need. And we believe it'll be far less than the $34 million that they want to spend in Rapid City to build a brand new domiciliary.
So what can we do to help, Patrick? You know, I'm looking at this, and I know there are going to be some cuts locally that they're talking about, possibly with the one Army camp here. What can people do? What do you suggest?
Well, can I mention some websites?
Sure.
Okay, there are a couple that are of particular interest to us, and one of the websites is SaveTheVA.com. SaveTheVA.com, and it's got a lot of the articles and pictures of our meetings with our elected representatives, town hall meetings, and comments from the public. Another website that our local group has established here in Hot Springs is called TheVeteransTown.com. And on there we have what we are currently doing. We have some surveys. We have contact numbers. And I think our citizens and our veterans should be concerned about this nationwide, because there are battles going on right now, and one of the most prominent is in St. Albans in Jamaica Plains, New York. And the VA is trying to do the same thing to them that they are doing to us. They want to tear down their hospital and build an apartment building.
So this just
veterans and the people in Jamaica Plains are very upset by this.
So this and just isn't
Hot Springs. Fighting the battle of their lives to maintain their health care.
So this just isn't Hot Springs, South Dakota. This is something that's going to take off across the country.
Well, and they've already closed one in Knoxville, Iowa, about 4 years ago. And it was 55 miles away from Des Moines. And, 10 years ago, that hospital had 600 inpatients. And they service thousands of veterans from Iowa and northern Nebraska. And they essentially just closed it up. Right now there are 40 people working there in an outpatient clinic.
That's why we've got to stop this.
Our leaders of the VA thought it was more cost-effective to close that facility up and send their patients up to the Des Moines VA, where they can now wait in longer lines, have more parking problems, and just making it more difficult for our veterans to get timely care and quality care.
That's no way to treat people that we call heroes. Again, the website, SaveTheVA.com and TheVeteransTown.com. We've got links at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Patrick Russell's name. It'll take you right there. Patrick, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for the information.
Well, I thank you, and wish us all luck, because this is for the veterans who have served us, and it's now time for us to serve them.
Absolutely. Patrick Russell, thanks so much. Quick break, right back after that. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized, and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8-hour 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Your working class radio experience, where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left, rich and far away. For the shirt that you carry on, blue denim, hell is vain. Oh, he's a working class man.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. So you remember the report I talked about sometime last year. By the folks at the American Society of Civil Engineers. And they've estimated, just for us to repair our failing infrastructure and bring it up to acceptable levels, we would need over the next couple of years to spend in the range of $2.2 trillion. That's roads, bridges, our railroads, the waterways, airports, public transportation systems, all of that. And it's all in desperate need of attention, according to the folks at the American Society of Civil Engineers, that are being proposed right now, both pathetically weak. The House bill, $262 billion over 5 years. The Senate bill, $109 billion over, I think it's 2 years. Again, way short of what we need. So I've asked Larry Handley, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, to come talk to us a bit about the bills and what we need. Larry, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, Rick, how are you?
I am great and getting better every day.
Good.
Our infrastructure, not so much so.
Uh-huh.
You look at these two pieces of legislation, and I'm saying it's woefully inadequate. We could be putting people back to work immediately if only we had leadership that would push this in the right direction.
I agree. And, you know, what we've done instead of building our infrastructure here in the States is we have traveled to foreign countries all over the world, blown up their infrastructure, and then rebuilt it. So there is something insane about what's happening in Congress now. And the fact that the Republicans in the House would design a bill with so many flaws, such a partisan bill attacking, it adopts all kinds of attack policies of the Republican Party, meshes them in with the infrastructure bill, and you know, that it just creates more problems than you can imagine. And it's really an attempt, I think, at politics, not at trying to rebuild the country.
Yeah, it's more about tearing down that black guy in the White House than it is actually about leading the country and making this the 21st century country that we need. You know, I've been saying this all week. I had seen a speech given by Thomas Friedman, and he said he came from Beijing to LAX, and it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones.
That's exactly right. The weird thing is that we picked this war, by the way, with the genuine Flintstones over in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the consequence is that our cities are actually turning into prehistoric towns.
So what do we do? I know the Republicans understand. Stephen LaTourette, the Republican from Ohio, came out and said $42,000 jobs for every $1 billion of infrastructure investment. They know it. Why aren't they doing it?
Right. Well, Congressman LaTourette gets it. The problem is that, you know, in the mix of the Tea Party arguments and the presidential election year arguments that are being made trying to tear down Obama, a lot of Republicans have been caught up in this frenzy, and they're voting wrong. They simply have no vision whatsoever, not only for America's highways, but also for America's transit. You know, in the transit industry, we've been suffering with cutbacks and cuts in service all over the country for the last 2 years. And what they've done here is to make it worse. And not only have they made it worse in terms of cutting funding for existing systems, they've taken transit completely offline and away from its dedicated revenue stream. But also they have language in the bill that would force transit agencies to surrender public bus routes to foreign private companies, multinational companies, who are in here in the States profiting by lowering wages of people in the transit industry. And we have several major foreign companies that have come here and hired Washington lobbyists who have worked their way through Chairman Mica and written into this bill strictures that would force local cities and transit agencies, in order to get additional federal funds for capital projects, that would force them to privatize at least 20% of their systems. So this is a direct giveaway to the people, again, from European bus companies that have come over here and lobbied our government to draw profits out of our country.
You know, I think as you laid this out, I'm thinking about the history of trolley cars in Cleveland and in Pittsburgh. You know, back 100 years ago, they had trolley cars running all up and down the roads. They were privatized,
right.
And the people who bought them and sucked them dry, let them die off, and then handed them back over in horrible disrepair, and they eventually tore it all up and it went away. And I see history repeating itself again.
Well, that's the story all over America. You know, transit originally was private enterprise, and in many cities it was tied to the folks who produced electricity. All the utility companies started transit systems because they actually made money selling electricity to themselves, essentially, to run the systems. You know, they found another way to make money. And after the huge investment of the federal government in the Eisenhower Highway Program after World War II, there was essentially an abandonment of transit by the private companies because they could no longer make money. The focus of the economy had shifted from mass transit into cars. And one of the generous groups that jumped in at the time was General Motors, along with the consortium of other highway lobby interests. And they bought up a lot of the trolley companies around the country and then cut the service to make it as painful as possible for people to use mass transit for the reason that they wanted to get people to buy their cars and to contribute to more highway growth.
I mean, and you, I guess you could make the same argument of what's going on today. The messaging I hear about high-speed rail or even light rail coming from where I live here into Harrisburg, well, it's not cost-effective, and people wouldn't take it, and it's every excuse under the book, other than it's a public good, and it's something that I really would like.
Right. Well, public good is irrelevant. You know, the question is, how can we shovel more money into the hands of private companies who then make campaign contributions? That's really what this is boiled down to, and that's what the Republican bill stands for. They have found every special interest that they represent in Congress, none of which, by the way, are the American people, and they figured out a way to shovel more money from the federal budget into the hands of their campaign contributors.
Well, what do you say to the people who say that, you know, just you know, the transit systems, they're just not profitable? We just can't make money doing them, you know, like in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. What do you say to those folks?
Well, first of all, no transportation system that involves more than a single person walking around their living room is profitable. You know, no one would say the highways have to be profitable. People just say, well, how do we create the funding stream to pay for the highways? And the same thing is true on mass transit, with the exception of the fact that mass transit is more environmentally sensitive. It creates less of a carbon footprint from the people who use it. It's much better for society, and it causes less accidents. More people arrive at home and at work safely when they use mass transit than private vehicles. And there are costs associated with all of those problems, such as the accidents, injuries, and paving the roads. So, you know, the idea that somehow transit should be isolated as the one sector of transportation that has to turn a profit is preposterous.
That's an excellent point. What should we be doing? I mean, I'm looking at these bills, and the White House has come out in favor of the Senate bill, $109 billion over the next 2 years, which I don't think is near enough. And according to the people at the American Society of Civil Engineers, they're saying the minimum of $262 billion every year just to get up to acceptable levels. I see it kind of scrawny and pathetic.
Well, it is scrawny and pathetic, but it's the best we have. We support the Senate bill over the House bill, obviously. We think it should be much bigger. We think it should be more far-reaching and more visionary, but it is what it is, and at the moment, it's the gold standard in Washington, so that we support that, but we think that folks should really be working the phones and calling their members of Congress, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, and telling them, you know, that it's really important to kill the current proposal in the House.
Yeah, I'm looking at this next election cycle, and you look at the two bills, the Senate bill and the House bill, which you could call the Democratic bill and the Republican bill, and I think there's some voting ideas in those bills, because you can look at their priorities, especially for your members. The CBO came out with a study, said that the Boehner plan would only 5% of the transit needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the bottom line is that they are trying to steer the country away from mass transit. You know, when they, you know, not only did they take transit out of away from its dedicated revenue stream, which is the gasoline tax, they took it out of that part of the budget and put it in the general fund. But they also said, in order to pay for the money that they need, the extra money they need in the bill, they are raiding federal pensions. They're attempting to strip federal workers of their pensions in order to fund highway production, and that's just ridiculous as well. The notion that, you know, federal workers have diminished pensions in order to avoid raising taxes on billionaires, which is the central part of all these discussions, is crazy. But that is what the House wants to do.
It's absolutely nuts. Larry Hanley, I appreciate the time. Great talking to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Let's take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The AFL-CIO says Thursday's announcement of an attorney's general settlement with banks on fraudulent mortgage and foreclosure practices is a step towards addressing the housing and foreclosure crisis that still plagues us. The $25 billion settlement provided some compensation for foreclosure victims and homeowners who are underwater on mortgages without requiring individuals to waive their legal claims. The AFL-CIO applauded Attorneys General Eric Schneiderman, Kamala Harris, and others who the Labor Federation says fought to improve the terms of the settlement. It's their efforts, the AFL-CIO says, that made sure banks have not been released from their liability for fraud and other illegal conduct involving mortgage-backed securities that were central to the Wall Street financial meltdown. The AFL-CIO is urging President Obama to, quote, provide the Federal Investigative Task Force with the resources necessary to address the $750 billion in negative home equity that is the result of illegal conduct by banks, end quote. Two Wisconsin Democratic state lawmakers Thursday introduced a resolution in the Wisconsin legislature calling for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision. State Representatives Mark Pocan and Chris Taylor introduced the resolution. Pocan says corporations aren't people and they shouldn't be given the constitutional right to buy elections. Pocan says this is the people's government, not the corporation's government, and corporations should not have the right to usurp the individual's right to free speech. Wisconsin State Representative Taylor says that corporations should not have the same free speech rights that people do. The resolution is part of a national movement to overturn the Money is Speech Citizens United decision. The effort is associated with Move to Amend. Over 1,800 Allstate insurance agents took a survey done by the OPEIU-affiliated National Association of Professional Allstate Agents Incorporated to measure the agents' satisfaction with the giant insurer. Allstate fared very poorly in the NAPAA survey, which used a model similar to Allstate's own customer satisfaction surveys. The company scored less than zero, with a higher percentage of agents ranking the company with negative answers in all categories than those who ranked it positive in every category. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org. Workers Independent News is produced and provided by Diversified Media Enterprises, made possible in part by the AFL-CIO. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, go to the website and download the podcast. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and you can take the program on the go. So like I said, today was the big conservative crazy action committee, their little shindig. And the news reports I saw, clash, conflict, there was, you know, there's struggle. There was with the Occupy people. They were sitting down and they were talking. That's the clash. Because, you know, the Occupy people would like to talk to crazy people. Crazy people not so happy. So the news reports, well, conflict, clash. I guess that sells. Anyway, this weekend in Philadelphia, there is going to be the 2012 Pennsylvania Progressive Summit put on by the good folks over at the Keystone Progress and a number of other organizations. And I've got the coordinator of this year's summit, Jane Palmer, on the line. Jane, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi. Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Tell me, what are you guys doing this weekend? The last couple of years, you guys have put on some fantastic shindigs. I'm sure this year is going to be just as good. But what are you doing this year?
This year is going to be better than ever. As you say, this is the third summit we've had, the first one we've had in Philadelphia, and we are so excited. It's going to Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny that you were talking about CPAC a minute ago, because one of the things that the commentators say is, you know, why doesn't the progressive side have big gatherings like that? And, you know, here we are. We're in Philadelphia. We're expecting hundreds of people. I'm looking at 600 to 700 people. These are activists, elected officials, campaign volunteers, issue advocates, you know, just citizen activists from all over the state coming together for training and inspiration and networking and a whole lot of fun.
But Jane, that wouldn't play into the frame. The frame is that only the right-wingers are organized and only their crazy people are coming together. There's no opposition to the insanity. That's the frame that they're pushing out there.
Yeah, well, that suits their interest, doesn't it? You know, it's just not true, and we know that. We on the left tend to do have some differences sometimes, and we sometimes get lost in the weeds. But one of the beauties of the Progressive Summit is to give people a chance to come together and see for themselves how big the movement is and how powerful and how diverse.
And how they can
to understand
involved.
That, you know, those of us who may want to, you know, split the issue in some fine grain ways really have much more in common than we have differences.
And to also get people involved. Because, you know, a lot of folks I talk to don't know how or what. The last two summits I went to, plenty of opportunity for people to partake in different things.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got, I think the count is 66. Separate workshop sessions. I mean, and each one of these sessions is run by, you know, the best and the brightest in the field. We've got state and national leaders leading our workshops. We've got a whole set of new workshops on what's going on in other states. For example, we've got Senator John Erpenbach from Wisconsin. He's one of the Wisconsin 14 that, you know, fled the state to fight against the so-called right to work nonsense of Governor Walker.
Yep.
We have so he's doing a panel on, you know, what happened in Wisconsin.
Maybe you can ask him what's going on now with the governor taking the settlement money to fix their budget hole.
Yeah, right. Yeah, talk about short-sighted. And they call themselves conservatives, right?
Yeah.
So we're actually starting tonight, Rick. We're in about an hour and a half. We're going to start the an attorney general debate, or as attorneys general, as they say, with Patrick Murphy and Kathleen Kane. We're really excited about that. We invited all the candidates, but those are the ones who agreed to show up. So we're very excited to have them talking. And for the first time, I think, in any venue, we are giving audience members an opportunity to ask the questions. So as people come in the door, they get a card and they get to ask a question.
And that's good. I mean, it's important.
Yeah.
Cause I think, you know, this mortgage thing, this foreclosure thing, this
mm-hmm.
is huge. And this is something that these attorneys general should really be running on, and we should be thinking about, because
absolutely
we should be holding these folks accountable.
Yeah. You know what's really interesting to me? One of the questions that I hope gets asked tonight is, what is your definition of the attorney general role? Because it's actually not that clearly delineated. There's not a very specific job description for it. And so that leaves it up to the person in the office to define it. And so I'm looking forward to hearing their answers about just how active they're going to be.
And if they've got aspirations of, oh, I don't know, maybe being governor.
Oh, maybe. That tends to happen.
You know, because you look at the last guy who was the attorney general, and look at the shenanigans that went on there.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that, you know, look.
And they're still going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, those if they broke the law, they'd belong in jail. But it was the way he went about it that really concerned me.
Yeah.
So over the weekend, you're going to be there all tonight, all through tomorrow, and into Sunday.
Yep.
To have these debates. Also, the Auditor General's
yes,
debate.
We have the Auditor General debate. So tonight we're at Art Street Methodist Church, just around the corner from the Convention Center, with the AG debate. And then bright and early tomorrow morning at about 9 o'clock, we start with the the sessions. We'll have a few opening speakers and then go right to our workshops. We have workshops throughout the day. We have a fantastic comedy night with some great comedians. We've got Lee Camp, we've got Jeff Chrysler and Katie Halper, people that show up on Saturday Night Live, and our very own Dalen Leach doing stand-up.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
It'll be hilarious. So that's tomorrow night, and then we go right into Sunday with more workshops, concluding with the Auditor General debate between Eugene DePasquale and Devin Cade.
Yeah, we've had Representative DePasquale on the program another number of times. I think he's a good, decent guy. I wouldn't mind seeing him as Auditor General.
Right.
I've been very happy with Jack Wagner on a number of issues, especially this charter school thing up in Mount Pocono that I've seen recently.
Mm-hmm.
He's come out with so a very powerful position, and I'd love to see someone like I don't know the other guy, but I know Eugene and I like him. So
right.
if someone wanted to get involved in this, they still wanted to show up, is it still possible?
It is still possible. Yeah, there's a couple of options. What we would strongly prefer is if they would go online and register at paprogressivesummit.org. Just go right to that website, www.paprogressivesummit.org. And you can register online. We would strongly prefer that.
Are you guys going to do any actions or anything? Any marching around?
We're going to do a march at lunchtime with the steel workers. We're going to go over to Sunoco, some facility, just a short walk from the convention center to protest the closing of the oil refineries and the loss of some great jobs and the potential abandonment of these oil refineries, leaving us subject to God knows what kind of environmental hazards.
Yep,
so,
absolutely. Any work with the Occupy folks that are in Philadelphia?
Not directly. We do have one interesting panel that's sort of organized around the idea of working with the ally movement and the ally energy, it's a beautiful energy. It's very strong, very powerful. And, other sort of issue advocacy groups can find ways to work with that kind of energy and maybe, to the advantage of all sides. I realize that I'd be remiss in not mentioning Keystone Progress here, Rick. I need to mention Keystone Progress because they are the real reason that this summit is happening. Are your listeners familiar with Keystone Progress?
Sure,
a lot of them are subscribers.
Yep, we've done a lot of work with the folks over at Keystone Progress, and I think they do great work across the state. And this is just
another
one of those things.
Amazing work. They were up to about 260,000 subscribers, which is a huge number. It makes us the largest online progressive advocacy group in the state. And Keystone Progress is the lead sponsor on this group, and we're very, very proud to be doing this. We're also partnering with Democracy for America. One of the whole training sessions is DFA training sessions, real kind of nuts and bolts, how to organize, how to get out the vote, and bolts of running for office, real on the ground kind of training.
Yeah, Jim Dean's group.
Yes, exactly. And Jim Dean will be here. Jim Dean will be with us.
And another reason to show up.
Another reason to show up, yeah. Yep.
Well, I look forward to hearing how it went. I'm sure it's going to be a great weekend of learning and experience and also networking. I appreciate the time and the updates. We will make sure we get some links to get folks hopefully to show up tomorrow.
Great. Thanks, Rick.
Jane Palmer, thanks so much. Coordinator
for the pleasure.
coordinator for the 2012 Pennsylvania Progressive Summit. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Jane Palmer's name. It'll take you right there. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Let's take a trip down the political rabbit hole to a mystical universe known as Newtland. This is where Newt Gingrich goes to get high on the fumes of his feverish ego and invent his own reality. For example, the current contender for the GOP presidential nomination has conjured up the fanciful claim that he is not, repeat, not a Washington lobbyist. Since lobbyists are right down there with loan sharks in public approval ratings, Gingrich thought it best to fuzz the reality of his decade-long lobbying career. He now insists that his favor-seeking corporate clients did not hire him for his insider connections in the capital city, but because he's a historian and a transformative thinker. So please believe him when he says that the financial giant, Freddie Mac, paid him $1.6 million over 6 years to give them history lessons. Also, just accept his word that he was paid $55 million by several healthcare corporations between 2001 and 2010 because they merely wanted to bask in the glow of his transformative thoughts. Indeed, when asked by the Washington Post what those clients got for their millions, Gingrich said that he set them up with, quote, a really important guy who really knows a lot and who really has lots of information. That guy was, of course, himself. And yes, admits the former House Speaker, he has chatted up his old congressional cronies about issues of concern to his clients, but he did so as just another concerned citizen. It was not, repeat, not lobbying. This is Jim Hightower saying, who does the Newtster think he's fooling? You can claim the chicken manure is chicken salad, but one whiff reveals the truth. Gingrich's silly semantical dance around the L word is a devastating revelation of his true character. This guy's so full of himself that he believes his own lies.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day comes from Mark McKenzie, the president of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO. He says, the fact that in 2012 I would be even sitting in front of the Labor Committee talking about eliminating the lunch hour is just outrageous. People should be able to at least be given an opportunity to eat, don't you think? Well, evidently not in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, they think it's just a dumb idea. It's an unneeded law. And we hear this a lot from the right-wingers. Well, people are following the law. We don't need it. In fact, that's the justification by one of the guys who sponsored this, Kyle Jones, a Republican up from New Hampshire. He says, you know, it's unneeded. If I were to deny an employee of mine a break, I'd be in a very bad position with the company's human resources representative. If you consider that this is a very easy law to follow in that everyone already does it, then why do we need it? He says our constituents have already proven that they have enough common sense to do it on their own. Again, you know, I go back to this, and it takes me back to why you passed the law in the first place. You passed the law in the first place because people weren't doing it in the past. And we said, you know what, it's probably a good idea to get people breaks. And understand, there are no federal laws that mandate that you get lunch or break, and most states don't have laws. So the fact that New Hampshire has one, I guess, is this business-friendly point of view. He's saying they don't, well, they already do it, and they do it voluntarily because they're good people and they do it out of the goodness of their heart. No, they do it because they're complying with the law. In states where they don't have it, they generally don't comply with the law. Only in places where it is actually the law do you see 100% cotton? And it's not even 100%. Because you look at the fact that Walmart has been sued for, $170 million because they denied workers lunch. There was a brewery not too long ago got nailed with $1.5 million. Embassy Suites, I think in California, had to pay tens of thousands of dollars to people who they forced to skip breaks. So this idea that, well, they'll do it on their own is nonsensical. And the idea that, well, since they're following, we don't need it. Could you make that argument with every labor law that we have? I don't think so. And it's that mentality scares me. Scares me an awful lot. Anyway, we've been saying for the longest time that fat people beware, you're next. It was one thing to go after the smokers, and we've seen companies across the country actually testing people's blood to see if they are smokers. And then charging them higher rates, or actually firing them. There have been a couple of places that have fired people because they were smokers, also charging them considerably higher rates. I guess now PepsiCo in upstate New York, they're seeking they're trying to put a $50 per month excise tax on health benefits for workers who are what they deem overweight or have conditions that may help them become overweight. Or if they smoke. So $50 a month they're going to charge in addition. Now, the Teamsters have said, wait a minute. We're going to go to the NLRB to say, no, you can't single people out like this. And this is another one of those reasons why you need to have representation. Add that to the story here in the state of Pennsylvania with the supervisors. Did you see this? That they're complaining that they haven't gotten a raise since 2008. And I said, you know, you haven't gotten a raise since 2008. Wouldn't that be a pretty good reason to, well, I don't know, organize? Because there are management unions. And you know what's pretty funny to me? A good number of them went from being union members, went from being workers up to management, thought they were going to have the world by the short hairs. And now they're figuring out that, hey, I'm working a lot. In fact, they pointed out that they were working some 50 hours a week and not getting much overtime. And, you know, you look at this and you're on a 37-and-a-half-hour week and you're working 50 hours. Had you had something like a contract, probably would have helped you. But I go back to this thing over the health care. This is what's coming down. And eventually it's going to go beyond smoking. It's going to go beyond weight. It's going to go to genetics. It's going to go to what they can find. And remember, the whole healthcare, one of the things I really like about Obama's healthcare law is the fact that there's no more rescission, and which, you know, is really kind of twisted if you think about it, that they actually paid a team of people and gave them bonuses based on how big the claim that they were able to deny and how much money it would have saved the company, gave them bonuses based on who they denied care to and how much it would have cost the company. They gave bonuses on that. So if you did something, you know, hey, you know, 30 years ago took an acne drug 30 years ago and now you've got some form of cancer, they're going to go back and say, sorry, you didn't tell us that you took that drug 30 or 40 years ago. You're gone. No health and no insurance for you, which in this country, if you don't have health insurance, you don't have health care, which means pretty much you die. And I look at that story out in California where the guy has insurance. He's an undocumented worker, actually had insurance, needs a transplant. And they refuse to do it because they're not sure if the insurance will cover it because, hey, he's undocumented. And if he gets deported, they're not sure he's going to get the follow-up care, so they're saying, we're not going to do it. And at last I saw, there was one of those change.org petitions going around. It had like 200,000 people had signed on to it to do the transplant. It's mind-blowing to me. Healthcare is one of those things that you don't get, you die. And, you know, I hear the right talking about, well, pursuit of happiness, life, liberty. What about life? You know, If you can't get access to good quality health care, you can't live. Just a thought. Another story that grabbed me today on the job is in Washington. They're trying, there's a hostess is going through bankruptcy. Now, the right has been really doing a great job of saying, well, this is about the unions. We cost too much money. And, they've driven us into bankruptcy again, even though they've given several concessionary contracts and helped bail them out a number of times. CEO is now going before the bankruptcy court and saying, hey, I should have my multi-million dollar salary and all of my benefits and all of that stuff. Even though all of the workers are getting whacked and all of the people are, all of the people they owe money to, they're going to get whacked. The CEO, he's going to be well taken care of. And I'm looking at this and going, well, that kind of is the direction the nation goes. We're more worried about the CEO class than we are about average everyday workers. We're even more worried about the CEOs than you are about the shareholders, which is kind of weird if you think about it, because the shareholders are supposed to be his main focus. It's supposed to be all about them. Instead, it's all about him. And, as I look at how all of this stuff is unfolding, all of the discussions about what we need to fix and all of the discussions about education and transportation and healthcare, all the things that we need to invest in and that we're not, why aren't we? Well, we're doing that because we've got a protected class. We've got a group of a small percentage of this country. They're the ones that we can't ask from. Because evidently they create jobs. And I look at Hostess. I remember when I lived in Cleveland, Hostess was a great job. And you look at what they did to it. Again, they saddled it with massive debt. And they screwed it over. And, it's kind of the whole thing I was talking about before. Where, they don't actually, these big hedge fund managers, these big tycoons, they don't actually make money. They don't actually have salaries. They take out loans. They borrow against companies. They leverage to buy other things. So they're always using other people's money to increase their scope. And it's masterful. I mean, it's pure genius. But at the end of the day, somebody's picking that up. And who picks up the tab? Well, generally, you and I. We're the ones who, it's always us. On a certain level, it's always been the people who are the worker bees. It's always been the drones who are the ones who get the shaft. I guess that's just how it's always been. I thought here in this country, this was the grand experiment where the worker bees actually run the country. We the people. I guess, you could make the argument that, wasn't really that way. You had John Adams who used to call the people the rabble. And, the unwashed masses. But at some point you thought in this country, if there were any, we would have an equal shot. And you look around the globe and really, of the industrialized nations, we're one of the most unequal. And they tell us that things are just wonderful. Yet we have statistic after statistic, and it's not me. I mean, it's not me making this stuff up. This is factual. Our health care is not the greatest in the world. Our education system is not the best in the world anymore. The number of kids going on and graduating from college, we're nowhere near being the top of the scale anymore. And why is that? I say we spend too much money on higher education. You know why we spend too much money on higher education? Pretty simple. Because we put profit to it. You look at these for-profit universities. I mean, it's mind-blowing. The money that they pay out to shareholders and to their CEOs, it's just mind-blowing. Yet that's what we're told. I mean, you look at the education system here in the state with these charter schools. We're just scratching the tip. Just scratching the tip. 15%? The first charter school started in this state back in 1993, 15% of their students had minimal proficiency, 15%? And they're saying that that's the way we need to go. That's the path we need to follow. We need to take the rest of our education system in that direction. No, I don't think so. Not a good idea in my mind. But if you listen to the governor, we need block grants for education. Give those school districts, you know, the pot of money so that the charter school can take their chunk first. And then, well, and then we have Chester Upland multiplied time and time again across the state. Not good times, which is why together we need to get to the polls and we need to choose. We're at the fork in the road. We need to choose. Are you going to go down the path of the common good, of the commons, of we the people, or are we going to head down the other path? The one that says we believe in more privatization and more profitization and less opportunity for our young and less health care for our old. That's the direction that the right wants to take us. And there are a number of directions, other Democrats that want to take us down that way as well. That's why we need to have active, informed, engaged voters. That's why this November is that important. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I think we're going to get somebody from the CPAC conference who's over there. Well, this ought to be fun. Back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, male hummingbirds sing with their tail feathers.
The courtship sounds of male hummingbirds don't come from their throats. They're made by wind passing through their tail feathers during steep aerial dives. That's according to a September 2011 paper in the journal Science. Co-author of the paper, Christopher Clark of Yale, figured this out by making a high-speed film of variously shaped hummingbird feathers in an artificial wind chamber.
When Clark analyzed the video, he found that individual hummingbird feathers work together to produce a kind of music. The feathers can produce varieties of sounds. In fact, males of each hummingbird species have their own signature sound. For example, here's a hummingbird called the white-bellied woodstar. And here's a black-chinned hummingbird.
Clark's team found that different notes can be produced by different feathers and work with each other harmonically, like notes in a song. Air moving through the feathers can also make a hummingbird's mating song softer or louder.
All that being the case, said Clark, a male hummingbird's mating success could depend on how well he masters aerodynamic moves, either to show off his flying skill or to generate an alluring sound.
For more, come to earthsky.org and search for hummingbirds. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Unhon and conservatism. Rick Smith.
Let's have a tea party like we're going to. We'll share the cookies too.
Yes, it would be big fun. Big fun indeed. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, that's the best place to go to get the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. I'm waiting on Dan Gaynor. He's a vice president of business and culture over at the Media Research Council. He's evidently at the big CPAC conference, and he's supposed to be calling in to debate, to argue, to carry on, whatever. We're going to hold on for him for a little bit to see if that happens. But, you know, what's going on today is, you know, you had some Occupy people who went over and said, hey, we'd like to protest. And, you know, the conservatives, you know, they most of them were pretty reasonable. Some of the pictures I've seen, you know, you're going to get your snarky comments back and forth. But for the most part, fairly reasonable, very, very DC-esque. I don't know that you could have something like that where I grew up, you know, on the west side of Cleveland. I think Anybody standing outside with baseball bats would probably end up in a real clash. And then I wonder how the media would, I wonder how they would structure that. I wonder how the headline would then read if people actually did go after each other with baseball bats. I don't know, but in a very DC way, they're having the conversation. And what I find interesting is this conservative, political action committee, full of really very, very far right wingers. This is a very, very right wing organization. What I'm finding interesting is they, you know, had Santorum there, rousing support. People thrilled to death. This is Santorum's crowd. These are the people who are, their main focus is in life is abortion and gay rights, and that's where they put their love and money. Not so much care about the economy, not so much care about you or me or poor people or anything, just about that. And then you got Romney, who I guess has gone into the belly of the beast, not their people, not his crowd. So you know, I'm hoping he calls because I want to see how this dynamic played out, because the crowd is very pro Santorum, and really been beaten up on Romney. What happens if Romney's the guy? Will the conservatives walk away from him? Will the conservatives say, well, you know, can't do that. You're too liberal for us. I don't know, I'm hoping to get a hold of Mr. Gaynor because a lot of things he said about Romney, and I'm curious what his position is on the contraception issue, because you know the folks at the CPAC thing hell bent on making sure that nobody has access to this, and I guess I just don't understand why. I think I've been through this before. The idea that the Catholic Church now wants to use the government to deny their parishioners access to birth control, to me, is just mind-blowing. You know, I get the whole go forth and be fruitful thing. I do. I get that. I think it's misguided. It really plays against the whole conservative mentality, you know, which if they believed what they preach, the conservatives, I might go along with some of it. You know, personal responsibility, taking care of yourself, self-reliance. I might buy into that if they actually believed it. So when someone wants to be responsible and they want to say, look, I want to make sure that I can't afford it. I don't have the money to support a child. I don't want to bring a child into this world. Whole bunch. I'm not mentally, physically, whatever. I'm not ready. I want to protect myself, and I want to make sure it doesn't happen. What we have is we have, you know, people saying no. You can't be personally responsible, and it seems kind of bizarre to me. But that's the position I think most of them have taken. Well, we've got Dan Gaynor on the line, vice president of the Business and Culture for Media Research Council. Dan, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, how are you doing today?
I am fantastic. How are things going at the big conference?
Oh, I think it's across the board. A lot of conservatives pulling together. I mean, the great thing about conservatives is we don't expect everybody to agree on everything.
Oh, okay, good. Because as the reports I've seen come out, you had Santorum there, who was very popular. Romney, not so much.
I mean, at this conference, a reporter that I know told me, because I didn't see this personally. A reporter told me that Eric Erickson of Red State had said that for Romney we'd solve a lot of problems and just weld the doors shut, solve all his problems. so it's not entirely, but I mean, I've seen a fair number of Romney signs. It's not like he has no support here.
How about you? I mean, I've seen you've said some things about Romney.
I'm definitely critical, but he's still vastly better than Barack Obama.
Oh, just as long as you're on that page.
I look at it as, the man has a great story to tell. He really is a self-made millionaire. He's been a successful businessman. He's not as good telling the story as he needs to be
to run for president. I don't know about the whole self-made thing. When your father's a governor of a major state, when he was
he didn't inherit that well. But there's a lot of people who are born on first base or second base who don't make it to third.
Yeah,
who actually end up sliding into the first or home. Going backwards.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it. But the reality is there's an awful lot of invisible capital and relationships and networking that come along with just being,
oh, yeah, like
being
I said, a
Romney.
Lot of people,
Working
in Washington, you see tons of people who have access to relationships and access to knowing people, and most of them do squat all with it.
Yeah, well, at the end of it, the story of that he pulled himself up by his bootstraps and whittled his own bootstraps, for me.
He did, but he maximized his opportunities, did well with them. And, I mean, as a conservative, I'm not about to bash somebody who's been financially successful. I think I would like to see more people be that way.
I'm with you. I'd love to see more people being able to have their work.
Sure. What's particularly upsetting to me, and like I said, I would support either Gingrich or Romney personally. I mean, you know, Gingrich or Santorum before Romney personally. But I am appalled at how the media are going after him for his faith. And I just,
Who's going after whose faith?
Going after Romney for his faith.
You saw
in New York Magazine, you've seen Huffington Post, and you've seen even the major media repeatedly refer to him as Mormon, which is one of those things they do
to make him sound
other than everybody else. Obama Christian. It's become a shorthand for Romney so that they remind people he's somehow different. But if you look at the stats, look at Gallup. Gallup polls show that Democrats actually have more problem with voting for a Mormon than Republicans.
Yeah, that's not an issue for me one way or another. And again, I don't think that the media has really focused on that as much as the right wants us to believe, because it seems to me that you know, the right has done a pretty good job of stoking the flame of this war on religion. And I'm sorry, I'm not seeing it, especially talking about this contraception thing. Where are you at on this contraception?
Well, I mean, when you try to force people who had to be Catholic to, and your president is supposed to be a constitutional scholar, and he's stepping all over not only the First Amendment, but the first teeth of the First Amendment that the founders considered to be more important above all others. Yeah, I have a problem with that.
Well, let me ask you this, Dan. You know, in looking at this, I saw the one poll, 95% of women who say that they're Catholic have used birth control at some point of their life.
Well, that's a good looker, Institute numbers, which means I believe them. Not at all.
Well, either way, you know, hold on, Dan. You know, as someone who was Catholic for most of my life, I would say every Catholic girl I ever dated was on birth control. We'll take that to a very small local level. Why do we want to use the government to deny the parishioners of the Catholic Church, who obviously, in this case, don't believe in their tenets? Why do we want to use the government against them?
But you're not using government. You're using the government to try to force people to violate their faith. It is one thing to say that somebody, hypothetically, the drugstore, buy condoms or buy birth control pills, both of which are very cheap and not really supposed to be covered by Obamacare anyhow. But let's say they do that. That's a personal act. That's not forcing the institution of the Catholic Church or people who are Catholic to violate their faith simply because you decide to cover something that is cheap and seems to go against the very tenets of what you were talking about for Obamacare.
So are we forcing them to take them? Because I seem to remember back in the 90s, the conservatives wanted welfare mothers. They wanted them to have Norplant. I didn't remember the Catholic Church going crazy back then.
Because you weren't making the Catholic Church provide it. You weren't making the Catholic Church pay for it and make sure. I mean, we have a archbishop in Baltimore who's slated to be cardinal who has said that if they have to, he will deny. Basically, they'll stop providing health care to everybody through the Catholic Church.
Well, I don't think the Catholic Church should be in health care anyway, but that's a whole other argument for another day. But, you know, here's the thing. This is, to me, an employment issue. You know, if you're going to employ someone and they don't believe what you believe, should you be able to impose your rights, what your beliefs on them? I mean, isn't that the core of the First Amendment?
Should they be able to impose their rights on you? Then, no, they shouldn't. Should they be able to force the institution that is the Catholic Church to violate its tenets, its precepts? No, they shouldn't. If they want birth control, let them buy it.
Well, and what we're simply saying is that it should be accessible through a health insurance plan.
And we're not making
health insurance a religious issue, which the right has done a pretty good job. You guys have done a great job of this, stoking these flames of.
Well, actually, no, Obama has done this. This is a travesty of PR. Would your own vice president tell you not to do this? You really, I mean, it's not just the right saying that this is an issue. It is
This is a Catholic issue. What Obama miscalculated, whether in fact a lot of people who are Catholic may use birth control sometime in their life, the real issue is they may do that, but they still vote with the church when they feel like the church is under attack. And what he's going to find, I mean, right now, even backing water as he's done, he's going to find that he has alienated a lot of Catholic votes for this.
We shall see, and that's what November is all about, and that's why you're DC for the big conference there. I'm sure this is getting a lot of play with the folks that you're walking around with.
Well, I mean, it's important to people, and which I mean, faith, whether you're Catholic, whether you're Christian, whether you're Jewish or any other religion, people having the right to practice their faith as they see it is an important conservative value.
See, I just don't see how this is in any way, shape, or form stopping anyone from practicing their faith.
If you
have the ability to abstain. You do not have to take birth control. But as an employer, you have to provide it as part of the plan. It's pretty simple.
Is a Catholic entity? No, they don't.
Well,
I think by making them do it, what you're making them in effect do is either close up shop, which is what my recommendation would be the Catholic Church if Obama hadn't backed off, would be to overnight close every hospital, every college, and every school in America that's Catholic.
Oh, yeah. Look, are you Catholic?
I was raised Catholic. I now go to a Baptist church.
Because I grew up Catholic. There is no way they'd give up that revenue stream. Sorry, not
happening. But I'm saying they wouldn't have to. Also, at the same time, you actually excommunicate. Start working your way through the Obama administration, excommunicating people.
Oh, that'd be great fun. And again, as I've said, once we decide that this is a Christian nation, we're not quite there yet. Once we decide, it'll be fun to watch the different factions eat each other.
They're not eating each other. I mean, no one expects.
You just said we're going to be excommunicating people.
No, but I mean, the Catholic Church is right. If Joe Biden, who happens to be the highest ranking Catholic in the Obama administration, if he's going to go on attacking the Catholic faith, he's at odds with the church. It's their right to kick him out.
So who's more important, the church or the presidency?
Depends on who you're talking about.
Boy, this takes me back to this.
What?
This takes me back to the arguments of the 60s.
But the church doesn't control the president, but the vice president doesn't have the right to A, call himself Catholic, and B, go to war with the Catholic Church.
No, I still see it the other way. I still see that this is just something very simple that you guys have really blown out of proportion.
Well, like I said, when it's not just conservatives who are saying it, but when liberals like Chris Matthews are saying it, you ought to...
They're saying it for political reasons, not a matter of what's right or wrong, just pure politics. That's what it's about.
It's not pure politics. This is what people really believe.
This is why we have elections.
I can tell you, as somebody who's here on the ground at CPAC, this is what people believe. They're really upset about it. And Obama, just as Truman underestimated how Planned Parenthood would react, Obama underestimated how Catholics and their supporters would react.
Well, let me ask you about Truman real quick. I got about a minute and a half left. Where do you stand on that? I mean, I think it was a dumb idea to even get involved in it. I had done a lot of work.
It was a dumb idea for them to be involved in it for the first place. Then they badly underestimated pulling out. Then they badly lied to people and said they wouldn't go back in, and they went back in. So they screwed it up every possible way they could do it. They've alienated conservatives who will no longer trust them because they were lied to, and they've alienated liberals who no longer trust them either, and who are still at war with them trying to shut them down. So, in fact, this is not the first time that the left has gone after Truman. Truman did some breast cancer. A scientific study which causes breast cancer back at the end of last year, and the left did not like the results, did not like that they didn't call BPA a cancer-causing substance, even though they couldn't find evidence that it was, and so they went after him then, and they're still going after them, calling for Brinker to resign.
Well, maybe she should. Dan Gaynor, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you. Have a good time at the convention.
I will. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
It was good talking to him. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To The Rick Smith Show.
It is
believe that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in the New World. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitative child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833, and consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Hughley Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant because they'll wonder if you're gay. You should hug a Republican.
Yeah, yeah, give him a big, big hug. Big sloppy wet kiss, just like we did with Mr. Gaynor there. And look, yeah, I mean, that's their position. That's why elections are so important. They've been led down that path, and you know, it is what it is. And you look at Santorum, you know, Mr. Right Winger, Mr. CPAC loves him. Mike points out, I got an email during the break. Mike points out something fairly interesting about his wife, who, according to an article that he sent me, had a six year long affair with a guy who was, well, he worked to start therapeutic abortion clinics. He was an abortion doctor. He was 63 years old. She was 22 years old. This was, according to Mike, right in the years before Roe versus Wade. Who was that? That was Santorum's wife. So, as Mike points out, your ex-senator seems to be akin to the Adams family, the one with Gomez, not John and Quincy. So, pretty good there, Mike. I appreciate the email. Also got an email from Jim who said, on our infrastructure, the last grade given by the Association of Civil Engineers overall for the nation was a D-. And, yeah, I mean, when you take into all of the roads, the bridges, the airports, the waterways, you know, all of that stuff, put it all, and you, I guess you could probably throw broadband access and internet access into that. Their report didn't. But we are far behind the rest of the industrialized world, and something we need to work, at getting up on. Andy also sent an email saying, Ricky got it right. Who's your daddy? Who's your daddy? He said, I ain't no governor's son. Dan Gaynor is out of his mind. Ask him what he's smoking. Yeah, you got a few contacts when daddy's an ex-CEO of American Motors, governor of Michigan, and ex-presidential candidate. Yeah, just a couple of contacts. And as Andy puts it, born halfway between home and third, he represents the plutocracy, the ruling class of the country, I was born into it. And he also questions the assertion by Gaynor that Chris Matthews is a liberal. And I probably should have questioned that. It's one of those moments where you go, is that where I want to fight this? And, well, but interesting. Maybe Eric Erickson's right. Maybe the best way to deal with the problems in our country would be to weld the doors shut and keep all the crazy people in one room. So there you go. I don't know if you saw this today, but the Westboro Baptist Church back in the news again. And I just don't understand the purpose. And maybe it's just a Twitter thing. Maybe they just tweet this stuff so people give them a little attention. They claim they're going to protest the funerals of the two boys who were killed when their father decided he was going to blow their house up. All because, and they claim, and I don't see how the two are linked. Somehow the legislature has passed a same-sex marriage law, and the governor is expected to sign it. And this guy who clearly lost his mind and, killed himself and his kids. I don't see how those are linked. But then again, when the mind goes crazy, as some of our conservative friends have done, and some of the folks who I know who are really way out on the religious extreme, maybe there's some link there that I'm just not getting. And again, you can always email me that rick@therickSmithShow.com if you've got a theory on it. I think my theory on the birth control is probably spot on. One, the Catholic Church, they can't control their members anymore. Look, 95 to 99% of the women polled had used birth control at some point. It seems like you've lost that battle. Maybe you should move on. Well, what they want to do is they want to use the government, to put their people in check. And then there's all the other thought I had. Maybe it is about, the people who are so adamantly opposed to women having access. Maybe they were unwanted. Maybe they were, oops, as Rick Perry would say, oops, abstinence is supposed to work. Maybe we just didn't apply it right. And boom, there you are. And maybe the parents, like Santorum, maybe his parents said, we didn't really want you, but here you are and we had to take care of you anyway. And he knows in his mind, being the self-loathing Catholic that I'm sure he is, figured if mom had access to birth control, I wouldn't be here, so I got to be against it. Just nuts. Anyway, today on the program, we talk with Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future about the progressive budget and the priorities of the Republican majority in the House and what we need to do to start turning the country and the budget process around. Patrick Russell was here from the American Federation of Government Employees, Local 39, talking about the VA hospitals across the country, and specifically the one in Hot Springs, South Dakota, that they're closing down. This idea that we're going to privatize the VA as the righties want, this idea that, you can just go to a for-profit hospital and we'll just be an insurance company, seems to me to be backwards and screwed up. And I fear that we will not honor the pledge again that we have made to the people that we put up on a pedestal and called heroes. We also talked to Larry Hanley, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, about the transportation bills, the one in the Senate, $109 billion over 2 years, the one in the House, $260 billion over 5 years. And like I said earlier, the reality is the Association of Civil Engineers have said we need about $262 billion every year. And that's just to fix up what we've got. That's no improvements. That's no expansion. That's no updating. No 21st century internet. No 21st century airports. Just to be okay. And that's scary stuff. Also, Jane Palmer, coordinator of the 2012 Pennsylvania Progressive Summit, was here talking about the weekend's festivities. Our good friends over at Keystone Progress will be putting on a great conference this weekend. If you're in the Philadelphia area, I hope you can attend. For more information on that, you can go to ricksmithshow.com and click on Jane Palmer's name. It'll take you right there. I hope everyone has a great weekend going into coaching the basketball again. So I'm looking forward to a fun weekend of doing that. And also knocking on doors. I'm going to go knocking on doors, passing out petitions. Anyway. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here Monday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the foot of sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rage.